Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And this week we're talking about the season finale for season 2, episode 210, Valor Morghulis. I think that's how you say it. He made me say it a lot of times.
Right. He just wanted to make sure.
Yeah.
Want to make sure you weren't just going to get all Twitter pated about his face change. Like, look,
you gotta remember
these
words.
You're about to see some cool shit. You gotta remember this for God knows how many seasons to come.
This is a phrase I definitely remember from the series.
I forgot how much cool shit that they left us with in this, because I remember when I was watching season 2, like, not being entirely on board with some of the plot, but, like, the Blackwater and then, like, oh, yeah, I remember all this cool shit's about to happen is a great way. Like, it's one of the things the show does well, even in off years, is, like, really ringing the bell and having you wanting dinner time and then just, like, nope, we're going away.
Yeah, I mean, that's the satisfying way that they do cliffhangers, I guess.
Yeah.
They tend to give you everything you wanted out of the season in, like, episode 9.
Mm-hmm.
And then episode 10 is just, like, table setting, like you said.
It's not even cliffhangers. It's, like, bridge builders.
Right.
Like look what's on the other side of here. Mm-hmm. Boy, I bet you want that. Too bad we have to build the bridge to get there. But, oh, shit, is it going to be... You're totally going to want to get on here and ride across because it's fucking cool. Look at it.
Yeah. And you've already had your meal for this season, right? You know there's another meal coming.
Right.
But this season's meal is done with. And it's not like they didn't do anything this season. So, yeah, I like how this show tends to handle its season climax.
Yeah, it's pretty good stuff. And it's, and you know, to be fair, it's also based on pretty compelling material. So
yeah, for sure.
That never hurts.
Yeah. So... Overall, you thought this episode was good?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing it does wrap up, I just, the Dany plot, for me, even so many years later and expecting it, just is a little bit of a wet fart. Like, they get into a very different experience that show Dany has in the House of the Undying versus book Dany. And I'm like, okay, this is different, but, you know, it's a different medium. If they did everything like they did in the book, maybe it'd give too much away, or, you know, it wouldn't work as well. But, so I'm get through there, and then she's just got these magical chains on her, and then it's kind of goofy looking, and she's got these three CGI dragons, Dracarysing, and, like, I just felt, like, very anticlimactic.
Huh, okay. I mean, they can't... The trouble is, they're little dragons, right? Like, what are they really going to do here?
Oh, I get it. I'm just saying that, like,
they're in a tough spot.
I know that the guy filmed what he filmed, and the CGI guys had to worry about having these tiny dragons spitting fire around her armpits and whatnot. But yeah. It didn't feel triumphant. It felt goofy and a little sci-fi-y. Like Siffy, not sci-fi, like S-Y-F-Y.
Not as good as when she walks out of the fire. Or I guess walks out of the rubble of the fire.
Right, that's what I'm saying. Like, I mean, compare this note of triumph, which is like, you know, her little chicken dragons breathing fire with, like, last year where she came out with the same chicken dragons, but, you know, she had just walked through fire to get where she was. I mean, I don't know, like, because it's not because her then, I thought, looting Duck Sauce's house was pretty badass.
Yep.
And, you know, maybe they could have even gone further in showing her sailing away on a ship. But, like, no matter how they dressed it up, I just thought the resolution of the actual "Where are my dragons?" plot was I don't know. Did you like it?
There were a couple cool moments. I think the effect where Jorah's following her around this circular path here
was super cool. Yeah, I really like that.
And super simple. You know, that's not an expensive shot to shoot, but man, it was effective.
Nope. It shows you how they're kind of masters the reality in this space.
Yeah.
And it sets the scene for an appropriate, you know, kind of like thrilling conclusion to this thing. And I just feel like they didn't have a great way to visualize it.
No, and I think maybe, you know, they had already played the, ooh, this spooky guy can manifest multiple copies of himself card.
Right.
In the previous episode. So I think... maybe if that had been more of a surprise, or if he had manifested, like, some other power that we weren't aware of already, it would have been maybe more impressive, but I don't know. I ultimately found it to be adequate. Yeah. I wasn't disappointed by it necessarily.
I guess I wish they had made it more of a battle of the mind kind of thing. Like the I think that a lot of that I think a lot of that came through the fact that like maybe they are distracting her with increasingly appealing like there's terrifying visions of the future, but then like places where she would want to linger, and maybe she could be they could just keep her in her mind in prison forever. And, you know, then do whatever magic they want to do with her and the dragons. But, and that played, but like her defeating their illusions, I don't know, should have been, they should have tied in somehow her defeating the illusions with her defeating them rather than, like I said, maybe it's not the problem I have with how it ended, just that it felt very rushed and the actual action was dumb looking.
I feel like at the very least it was a short-sighted plot, because I don't know what they think is going to happen with those dragons like a year, 2 years, 10 years from now.
Right.
But that little pedestal is not going to contain three dragons for very long.
Right.
And at some point, you got to move them. And how are you going
to
do that?
I mean, they got time to figure. I mean, they're just buying time to figure things out. You got three.
You can't buy too much time.
You got three dragons
though.
And mother dragons. You can afford some renovations. You got the power of the King of Karth behind you. Like I mean.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to have to blow out the ceiling and blow out the walls. It's
right.
just going to be, they're going to be on a balcony at some point.
Right.
The observation deck. But, okay. Yeah, I think we both liked the episode, so let's get into the recap.
Before we get into the meat of the episode proper, some housekeeping. Of course, we've got every week The Walking Dead and Mr. Robot on Tuesdays and Fridays, respectively. And this is also the last season or last episode of the American Horror Story cult season that Sess and I have been covering. So we'll see the thrilling conclusion of that. Jim and I are going to be talking about The Deuce on Bald Move Television this week. It's a separate podcast you can subscribe to on baldmove.com. We're also going to be seeing Justice League for our first run Bald Movies. Except for Jim is buying a house that night. It's going to be me and Cecily, who is my co-host on the American Horror Story podcast, talking about Justice League on Thursday night. We're also, for club members, going to be playing The Wolf Among Us, the latest installment. Is that the final installment? I think there's one more.
I think there's one more after this.
We're on episode 4, so we'll be...
I think so, yeah.
The penultimate episode of Wolf Among Us, which, if you don't know, that's a Telltale video game, and we try to play it the worst way we can. Our goal is to always take the path that no one else takes.
Mm-hmm.
And we statistically prove it at the end of every episode. And then also another thing coming up this week is our Stranger Things Season 2 wrap-up. We've been collecting feedback and everyone's thoughts. We're going to come back to tie a nice little bow on that until Season 3. And that's what's going on at baldmove.com.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
For Prestige, me and Aaron are still extending our Shogun Afterglow with part 3 of our discussion of the 1980s TV miniseries. Last week absolutely shocked our sensibilities with Lord Torinaga doing the tango. What delights and horrors will await us this week?
Then for Pulp, this Friday join us for our latest prep session for House of the Dragon Season 2 as we take another look at the key differences between the text of Fire and Blood and the on-screen action for Season 1, and what they mean for the characters, story, and setting. Get your Valyrian steel sharpened for the new season.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We start off with Tyrion waking to find himself horribly scarred and humiliated because his father has saved the day and he has also relieved him as Hand of the King. And Pycelle's being a real D-bag about it.
Boy.
Understandably. I kind of like the moment where Pycelle flips in that coin and says, payment for your services.
Right. I mean, it's...
Or for your troubles.
Sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. But, like, I guess... I remember when we were talking this season up, like, oh, man, this is peak Tyrion. Because I thought that they had put this whole thing, like to the beginning of season 3. Like, I thought maybe that they kept Tyrion's status as a... I thought a lot of this was like opening for season 3, which, you know, to be fair, most of the final episodes of Game of Thrones are essentially prologues for the next season.
Right.
But boy, it's the best of times, it's the worst of times. Like, as cool as it was to see him accost Grandmaster Pycelle and shave his beard, like, it's that bad, it's that much suck when he comes in, that smug look of like, oh, you have nothing, and I've got my hands back on the levers of power, and, you know, go get your shoebox. Get your shine box. It's not cool. It's not cool. We don't even get to see, you know, Tyrion and Bronn stuff him into a trunk and stab him to death. Like, it's just pure unanswered provocation, and there's nothing Tyrion can do about it.
No.
And then the fact that he, like, makes a point of your father rode in to save the city. Like, the victors have won, and history is being written by them while Tyrion is recuperating on his bed.
And that's, he won't, like, be remembered.
Yeah, and that's what you get, like, even before Varys comes in to explain it for the people that weren't keeping up. Like, this is it. This is Tyrion's shot at a legacy and something greater, and it's being taken from him systematically.
Yeah, and by his father, which is the extra slap in the face, right?
Well,
Tywin says he's all about dynasty
right.
and all about family, and yet he's going to claim this glory for himself.
See,
certainly.
I don't... At this point, I'm not sure, because I'm thinking, okay, Tyrion was the only one that's really on Tyrion's side. Mm-hmm. If you look at everybody else in a small council, like, you know, there again, this goes back to one of the things we talked about, like, what if Tyrion wasn't as big of a dick about rubbing his power in people's faces? I probably they still would have taken the opportunity, but, you know, if Cersei and Pycelle and Varys and Littlefinger are greeting... you know, Tywin, and who is going to stand up besides Varys and say your son was instrumental to the defense? Like, you would have been too late had it not been for Tyrion's master plan, and also you might not have had enough men or whatever. Like, I don't know if we know enough to say Tywin has done him dirty, or whether Tywin was just acting on information that was self-serving and inaccurate.
Yeah, I mean, not saying that Tywin is purposely taking that, but he is going to get the credit. All the credit for it.
Right, from that stance, yes, his father's the one doing it. But I just wanted to put that little bit of...
And you can see
of...
that later on. I mean, he's made Hand of the King, and pronounced savior of the city. Like,
He's literally shitting on the throne.
He is, yeah. So let's talk about that. Tywin rides into the throne room on a shitting horse, where Joffrey proclaims him savior of the city, Hand of the King. Joffrey also gives Littlefinger Harrenhal, which... is interesting because Tyrion had promised him that in the canary trap that he set for him earlier on, and I don't think that was serious, but he ends up getting it anyway.
I think it was serious.
I mean, Littlefinger showed very little interest in it, but he does get it here, and I think he's happy to have whatever he can get.
Right. I mean, it's like one of those things where you're giving away. First of all, Harrenhal is interesting because it's a Riverland holding. So you're essentially giving away the possessions of one of the enemy houses, which is always fun. And secondly, it's got this reputation, like even though it's one of the wealthier lands and holdings, it's also got this reputation for being cursed.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's a perfect thing to give the Littlefinger because it's unlikely to lead to anything. It's going to keep him wealthy and influential like he wants, but it's also not going to be something that he's going to build a dynasty of his own off of. I think that the Tywin rubber stamping that kind of gives... to me, I'm thinking that's like Tywin giving his blessing to the deal. Like, yeah, that was a good deal because Tywin doesn't honor. I don't think he would honor the deals that weren't good. Although he did also pay off the Hill tribes.
Yeah,
because that might have been just easier sway to get these violent, crazy people out of the capital. Like, okay, give them their steel and gold, their promise, and send them on their way.
Yeah, and he does owe them a debt.
Yeah,
certainly.
And
Lannisters always pay their debts.
Right.
So I think there is some sense of fairness within Tywin.
Right.
And if he promises something, gives his word, he's not going to go back on it.
But it's almost like even if Tyrion made an outrageous promise, like he would still be inclined to honor it because the Lannisters always pay their debts is such a huge thing. Like, you know, when you're dealing with like diplomacy and foreign power, the ability to keep your word is so fucking important, which... it's interesting when you think about it in terms of modern day. Like the only thing a nation has in it is, as far as political capital, is the fact that it can make a deal. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter if it's a good deal, bad deal, whatever. Make a deal and live by the terms of the agreement. Because else, next time you want to make a good or bad or whatever deal, the other nation sitting across from you is like, well, fuck you.
There's no incentive for them to believe you.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's every incentive for them to backstab you.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
And Tywin understands that because he's a smart ruler.
Yep. So there's some talk about what's proper in the eyes of the gods and the people, and Joffrey decides to set aside Sansa and marry Margaery instead at Loras's request.
Man, this is such a fucking bunch of bullshit.
Sansa is relieved, but Littlefinger counsels against thinking that Joffrey is through with her, and he offers to take her home, but she turns him down.
This is just theater. And not
course,
particularly
yeah.
good theater at that.
No.
And Joffrey is the worst.
He is.
So, I mean, like, I can't set aside my betrothed. And Pycelle's like, actually, YOLO. the High Septon has found that there is support for you only live once in the books, Your Majesty. And I like this, like, Sansa's kind of uncertain, but she thinks, oh, okay, this is going to be me getting what I want. And then Littlefinger comes in there to start mind-fucking her. I like the line that, like, when she said, you know, she defaults back to the towing the party line that's impressed Tyrion so much.
Mm-hmm.
And Littlefinger's like, yeah, we're all liars here, and every one of us is better than you.
Yep.
Like, he's the first one to be like, listen, child, you might think you're being brave and clever, but we all, like, all of us see what's actually going on.
Mm-hmm.
I think he might be the first character that has actually publicly caught her in a lie and told her, you're not all that.
Right.
And that bothers her, as it should.
Yeah, it should. It shows that he's correct. And that's the thing. Littlefinger has, in my opinion, masterfully coordinated this whole thing, right? I mean, from getting Jaime headed back to King's Landing to getting Margaery married to the king, or at least betrothed to the king, that a lot of this has happened at Littlefinger's... at Littlefinger's behest.
Yeah.
He's the guy pushing this forward. And I think, you know, that Tywin giving him Harrenhal is certainly an acknowledgement of that. But I think you've got to consider where Littlefinger is coming from. And when he tells Sansa that everyone here is better at lying than her, he's got to be saying that this is part of a longer game
right.
that he's playing. You
right.
know, he doesn't do these things because he really loves the Lannisters.
Right.
He does them to get ahead. And I don't think Harrenhal... certainly from what we've seen of his discussion with Tyrion, is his ultimate goal.
No, but it is like his first thing. Like Littlefinger is called Littlefinger because he comes from the poorest of the poor tracts of land called the Fingers that are on the east coast of Westeros. Like it's barren and rocky and windswept, and it's not great for crops. You can maybe make a meager living raising sheep there, but it's like he's the little finger because he's from the most minor house from the fingers, mm-hmm. and now he owns one of the most wealthiest. Like, this is the first he's made money flipping gold dragons and collecting interest and leveraging the shit out of it and doing all the things that the banks got destroyed a couple years back for in real life.
Yeah, the prostitution.
Yeah. and now he's got his own thing. Like, he can generate wealth by his own accord, and mm-hmm. that's, you know, a dangerous man like Littlefinger. It's a dangerous thing to have.
Yeah, it's a step in the right direction for him. So then we go over to... Actually, why do you think Cersei lets Sansa off the hook here, I guess? Because she's making the case that Joffrey doesn't have to marry Sansa.
Oh, I just think that this is a much... Like,
I think she's like, leaning into the larger plan.
Yeah,
but she seemed
the Tyrells are a much better. Like, the Starks are all but extinct, and if they if the Lannisters win, they probably will be. So, like, there's no influence. There's nothing.
But that doesn't seem like a Cersei thing to me. That seems very much like a Tywin coming in, laying down the law, and saying,
"Okay,
you must do this, and I don't care if it offends you because you want to stick it to Sansa."
Yeah, I don't know that he had to twist her arm that much. I think she probably didn't see the deal there, and he's like, this is the new deal, and you need to get on board. And she's like, yeah, okay, fine.
Yeah.
Because, like, I don't know. Like, making Joffrey marry Sansa is pretty small beer when it comes to revenge plots.
Yeah.
Especially, like Littlefinger points out, they can just keep her at court and abuse the shit out of her and still get all the awesome wealth and power from the Tyrell alliance.
That's true. All right, so Varys visits Roz, who tries to seduce him until she discovers who he is. he offers to make her a partner in some venture targeted at Littlefinger, which I don't think we are supposed to understand exactly what it is.
Yeah, I mean, Varys is off balance here. He's kind of the odd man out.
Yeah.
He backed the wrong horse, mm-hmm. and now he's looking for ways to shore up his political weaknesses and get back on top with the constant rivalry he seems to have with Littlefinger.
Uh-huh.
Because they're both the same. Like, they both came from nothing. They have no obvious advantages except for their wits, you know. And they're trying to make the most of it. And Varys doesn't want to go into season three. he knows season three's coming up. And he's got nothing. He's got no irons in the fire. He's got to get an iron in the fire.
That's right. His best friend has just been completely removed from power, so he's not going to get any help there.
His nose was almost cut off, despite the Lannister face.
One of my all time favorite Varys moments is this look he gives when Roz grabs his crotch. Just this, like, this eyebrow.
Right. It's like a very Spock when McCoy's giving him shit about his green-blooded Vulcan ways.
Oh, it's incredible. I laughed out loud. I watched this twice and both times. It got me.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
So Brienne and Jaime come upon three corpses swinging from a tree. Brienne starts to take them down, but three men come across them and they ask what they're doing. Unfortunately, one of them recognizes Jaime, and Brienne has to kill all three of them.
Yep. This is a nice little thumbnail sketch of why it sucks to be a woman in Westeros. You know, they lay with lions. Like, Jaime puts out a pretty compelling case of probably what happened here. Mm-hmm. Like these women confronted with a band of armed. Let's break down all the bullshit things that are wrong with the scene. These women, they're confronted with an armed band of Lannisters. Mm-hmm. They can either be raped and killed, or maybe they can come onto the Lannisters and survive the encounter,
and then be killed by their own.
Then
their
when they do
Northmen.
That, like the shit that they didn't see happening to them is their own men, like not taking pity on them, but calling them whores and hanging them, and you know, apparently gang raping one of them to death. It's a real shit choice to make.
Yeah, not to mention the scene starts off with Jaime teasing Brienne about being this big beastly woman who's fighting off all the men, and no one's strong enough to pin her down. Like,
I mean, sometimes this stuff is finessed really well because, like, the way they staged that with him, you know, mocking her about having sex with her and making you feel like a real woman, and then they turn the corner and there are three quote-unquote real women swinging from the trees. Like, I'm pretty sure Brienne knows what it's like to be a real woman. If she didn't, like, we get to see, like, firsthand, like, that face she makes when the guys just bust out laughing at her, like, that, like, just kind of, like, closing her eyes and counting to 10. That's the face of a person that's just met that reaction countless times throughout their life. Like, mocked by people that are inferior to you in any axis you want, like character, fighting prowess, honor, wealth, position, and like you know, it's like they're just, these guys are just fucking assholes, and she has to put up with it,
or not. She can just kill him.
Well, yeah,
when she ends up doing
what she does when they make a move on her. Yeah, because that's the thing. Like, she'll do it to protect her mission, but like you know, it's easier just to let the slings and arrows, I guess, slough off of you. You know, you can tell that the anger that she must carry all, you know, her entire life comes out when she finally has to kill these guys. And the last one, she dispatches the first two with that much effort. And then the other one, she says, you know, two quick deaths and then just slowly guts this guy.
Well, if I was going to kill Axl Rose, I'd probably do it slowly.
that Chinese looks, democracy era.
Looks just like him, man.
Axl Rose, sure. Yeah. I can see that.
Something about this dude's face. I don't know.
For the first time, I think Jamie is slightly impressed by Brienne of Tarth.
Yeah.
That look on his face when she takes care of business, it sobers him up pretty quick.
Yeah, at the beginning of the fight, he's all like, cut me loose so that I can fight them if need be.
Right.
No, there's no need for that.
And this is the first time that he's really seen her go to work, too.
Yeah.
Because, like, Kat saw her worth and beating Loras's ass, but Jamie hasn't.
Yep.
I'm kind of surprised Jamie hasn't heard of her, now that I mention it.
Because,
the Tarth is not, like, a great house, but it is a noble house, and that one of the Tarth daughters is this, like, giant warrior woman you'd think would spread around either with derision or just, like, the freakish novelty of it.
Yeah.
But
you'd think so. Maybe she's got to practice with somebody.
Maybe it says a lot about what Jamie's just, like, doesn't give a shit. Like, you know, if he hasn't been to Tarth, he doesn't even know it exists. He's just that self-absorbed.
Could be. All right, Catelyn lectures Rob on how stupid it is to forego his marriage to the Frey girl in favor of Talisa. She tells him that Ned and her didn't love each other when they got married, but they grew into it, and maybe that'll happen with the Frey girl. Rob is not interested in her counsel for various reasons. A, he wants to marry Talisa.
Right.
And B, she's just betrayed him.
Right. She has no moral high. And that's the tragedy of it, right?
Right.
The
fact she's saying really intelligent things, but she's already proved herself to be untrustworthy. And
exactly. And this is the truth. Like, we talked about, and that's the thing, like, it's really hard to talk about the previous betrayal without this, because, yeah, in isolation, you can say, well, maybe the Camp of Sins and the Savagery or whatever, you know, maybe this happens, maybe that happens, but she can never give Rob counsel again, and Rob needs good counsel. Like, Rob doesn't have, like, a really solid hand. Like, you know, you've seen his bannermen. They're all a bunch of reactionary, you know, testosterone-filled jackasses for the most part. Mm-hmm. He needs someone like his mother that can give him that leal counsel that you're always wanting from, a hand or an advisor. And, you know, she fucking did something. And again, the tragedy is there's no possible way her plan would have worked.
To give Jamie back.
She would never have gotten her daughters.
Kids?
Like,
yeah.
Honestly,
no
letting
way.
The camp devolve into a little bit of savagery and letting the little, like, that would have been the better play in the long term, but I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, Catelyn here, I don't know. I view Robb Stark very much the same way I view Stannis Baratheon, in that he's a really excellent military commander.
Right.
But he's shit when it comes to his emotions.
Yeah, and also...
It's a different side of the coin, right? Like,
right.
Stannis is all buttoned up and doesn't even want to acknowledge that he has emotions.
Right.
Rob is kind of the other way around.
Right.
Like, he's very prone to just living off his emotions, but...
Right.
They're both really brilliant military commanders, just shit at the politics, and that's where his mom comes in. But you just... He's not taking her advice, and she's made a couple bad decisions.
Right. And the other thing I kept striking me is, like, just how young Rob is.
Yeah.
And, like, I was going on this mission to save my dad, and I can't do that anymore. So, like, literally every drop of blood I spill now, like, my mom gave away the one thing that we might have been able to get my sisters back. So every drop of blood I spill now is just kind of for this weird philosophical point around honor and justice. Like, I could march my friend, I could march my family back home and live with my castle. And, like, he just is this, he doesn't have any passion for this. He's, like, just really bummed out. And, you know, damn it, he's going to have a little bit of happiness. Like, I didn't get that, you know, I didn't get to really grow up and sow my wild oats. And, like, then you forced me in this marriage with the Lord World of Frey. And now you've shown this, like, grievous lack of judgment. And I'm wondering if even that was necessary. I trusted you. Like, there's a lot of, like, bitterness and anger to all this that I think comes out in the performance and when you look at it. But yeah, he's just a kid. Yeah. He's just a kid, and this is a bummer. This sucks now.
Speaking of the other side of the Stannis coin, Stannis is pissed at himself for trusting Melisandre. They're back at Dragonstone. Is that where they are?
Yeah.
I think they made it back there. He's ashamed of the things he's done in the name of the Lord of Light, and Melisandre makes yet more promises about his future, but it's not really convincing to Stannis. So Melisandre shows him something in the flames, which appears to impress Stannis.
Yeah,
in some way.
She slips some LSD into his wine.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess
this is a great scene.
It is a great scene.
I really like this scene a lot.
Do you think with no knowledge of the future, do you think that she's tricking him? Or bewitched? Because I always got the impression that maybe she's bewitching him. Because
bewitching him? Okay.
Why wouldn't she have shown him the flames? Like, if you could show him the flames and this guy's super skeptical, why wouldn't you do that from the get-go? Like,
have it in your back pocket, I guess.
This is the trick you play when you're in the situation where the person's it's the scam you play when they're about to back out of the deal. Mark is about to back out of the deal.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess there is obviously magic at play here, so it's certainly possible that she is putting some kind of spell on him.
Yeah.
To control him. But at the same time, Stannis seems very much out of her control in this scene, too, for at least a moment, right? I mean, he puts his hands around her throat, and he could have choked her to death here. That's a funny thing about prophecy, right? If you've seen prophecy and you believe prophecy,
right?
You're kind of on autopilot, and nothing you do matters at all unless there's some part of the prophecy that you need to fulfill personally.
Right.
But if Stannis is the guy, just let whatever happen. And I feel like she does that here when she's got, you know, Stannis has his hands around her throat, and she just kind of lets go. Right.
Right.
And she says, okay, this is going to be what it is. And if this is where I die, this is where I die. But I know it leads him down the path that I've seen.
Plus, she defeats him with an act of her own, a demonstration of her own faith.
Right, right. That she's willing to die for her cause, and therefore Stannis should be too.
Or I'm so trusting in what I've seen in the fire about you being the one that either my death here is serving to that, or you're not going to kill me.
Exactly.
Either way, I'm fine with it, and that kind of wins him over.
Yeah, I feel like she should just be roasting marshmallows on a fire if like this prophecy is going to just carry itself out, right?
Right. Well, I mean, I think you pegged it where it's like there's things that are destined and there's things that are prophesied, and like depending on how you interpret it, those are like it's an unbreakable chain of causality that you can't get out of. But then there's others that require you to have faith, like. You need to go to war and put yourself out there in a battlefield and risk death, but the prophecy is that you'll win.
Yeah.
So it's like it's a de facto act of faith to show up.
Yeah. I just wish there would have been a little more discussion from Stannis' side about how he does feel strung along here, you know? He does feel like, okay, every time we get a step back or the prophecy seems to have gone unfulfilled,
right.
You just come up with new bullshit to keep stringing me along.
I mean, he did that. There's a little bit. He says you promise, but you don't know. Like,
yeah.
I don't know how much more they could have done that without it starting to look like he's harping on the point. Because you know what?
I guess the wording didn't do it for me. But
I don't know that you want Stannis to look weak or indecisive or afraid too, because that's not like he could be angry.
I mean, maybe he should be after this battle though.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, he's just had his troops decimated. He you know, as he points out, he killed his brother. What for?
Right.
You know?
Like, that was like, but that was a major victory. But now it's like fairly hollow because he took all that and literally set it on fire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. Really good scene. So we go on to Theon, who's sitting in Winterfell. Another pretty good scene. He's listening to the world's most annoying horn blower. Maester Luwin explains siege tactics to him that he already understands. And Theon whines about being a prisoner of the Starks for his entire childhood and not having the support of his father. Luwin tells him, hey, you can escape through the secret passages and you can join the Night's Watch. And he decides, nah, I'm not going to do that. Instead, he gives his men a pretty inspiring speech, which results in him being knocked out and his men surrendering. And they also kill Maester Luwin in the process, or jab him with a spear.
Yeah, I mean, that's something you give. Like, there again, this is Theon's kind of, it feels like Theon's last chance to turn things around. Mm-hmm. and try to find a noble way. And he's too afraid. I think he would have gone had he known that Jon Snow's not up there.
Okay.
The going to Jon Snow, who he's kind of like, if you recall, like in the first season, he was kind of a dick to Jon. Like, not like openly, but like, you know, the fact that I think if you put this conversation together, he probably enjoyed the fact that there was someone at the castle that might have been a lower status than even he.
Yeah.
Like, he's aware that he's a hostage and he's this prisoner, but he's got to scrape and be thankful. And also, like, that's probably a lot to take in for a child, the fact that you are this hostage and a prisoner, but, like, your prisoners are good guys.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you know,
and you're still of noble birth,
right? And
you should
be proud of. So, like, I feel like going to the Night's Watch, I don't think he thinks that John would kill him. I think he's worried that John would just always look at him like you're a piece of shit, and he would never be able to forget that he's, like, most guys go to the Black and they can just, like, whatever you did down south is forgotten, and you can be whatever you want, but there's one guy in the wall that's always going to know what a huge piece of shit you are. You never can run from it.
Yeah, it's like if your dad was at the wall, right?
Right.
Like if Jorah went up there and Gior is the Lord Commander.
That's a great, and your dad, that's a really good, probably another example of why Jorah fled rather than taking the Black, because, oh shit, who wants to live in a constant state of, like, it's like a doghouse you can never get out of on pain of death.
Yep.
But it's his last chance to try to do something noble with his life. And again, another fundamental misunderstanding. This is the speech you give to the Starks when they have to stand between their house and extinction. This is not the speech you give to Iron Islanders.
Yeah.
They don't want to fucking die for your stupid ass. Like his sister Yara tried to tell him this. His father tried to tell him this. Dagmar tried to tell him this. They're not going to fucking die for your dumb ass.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's not their Iron Islander way. So
even
it's
if
a great
you had
speech,
been there,
it's to the wrong type of person.
And I feel like it's at the wrong time too. Like, you're gonna get these guys all hyped up, and then there's gonna be 3 more hours of sitting on your ass waiting for the attack, or 4 more months of them sieging you inside your castle. Like,
I think he was gonna ride. Wasn't he gonna like ride out to meet them, or like he was?
I don't know.
He couldn't. This fucking horn was really getting to him. It's the telltale horn,
for sure. Okay, let's move on to Varys.
So we mentioned Luwin getting stabbed in the guts.
Yeah.
Okay, because he got totally stabbed in the guts.
He did. Stab, twist, rip.
That was pretty shocking. Mm-hmm. I kind of thought the old man might make it out. Because, again, the maester stays at the castle. There's no... That's like, you know, fucking... breaking all the mirrors in the castle before you leave it. It's just...
I thought Winterfell would make it out, but it doesn't appear so.
Oh,
like,
man.
Winterfell is razed, man.
Yeah, that's a real hard scene. It's a beautiful one where they're all leaving the castle, and you can see Winterfell just in ruins and smoking behind. It's not great. Not great, Bob.
Yeah, funny, this is the scene where Theon says, oh, I saw this place and I thought, it's been here for thousands of years. It will continue to be here for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
In this very same episode where it's burned not quite to the ground,
right,
but as much as you can burn a castle to the ground.
Burn a stone castle.
Yeah.
Right.
I thought that was fairly ironic. All right, we go over to Varys. showing up at Tyrion's place with news that Cersei tried to kill him on the battlefield. He also says that Bran and the Hills tribemen have left him. Then he surprises Tyrion with a visit from Shay, and she unbandages his scarred face and tells him they need to leave before he's killed, but he can't bring himself to leave the life he's become accustomed to, and she decides she's going to stay with him as well. What'd you think of this Shay scene?
It's not bad as far as Shay scenes go.
Yeah.
I just, again, like, I, you know, we got another passionate defense of Shay this week, and I logically, I don't doubt the words they say. It's just, I think it comes down to the execution, the acting, and the, like to make a character like this compelling, I think you have to have A plus on all those, and like, we're not even getting C minus on some of them.
Yeah.
So it just kind of rings hollow to me.
I do think that this is another good Shay scene, and I find myself saying that more often than I expected in season two.
Mm.
So I don't know if it's like stuff that happens later on, maybe that made me dislike Shay so much, but it's kind of irrational. I want to say there isn't a great reason why I hate Shay, but it comes down to something that I just have this visceral dislike of her, very much in the same way that Tyrion has this connection to her, right?
Yeah.
You can't say at the same time, like, oh, Jim and Aaron, why do you not like Shay? Because, Tyrion, you have all the logical reasons in the world to not get involved with Shay.
Right.
And when it comes down to it, it's irrational and it's silly. But
do you mind if I just read this email right now? Because it's like... It cuts to the heart of this discussion. It's Leah W., she says, I respect you not liking her character personally, but her character makes a lot of sense if you look at her as a woman who's gone through trauma and has an unhealthy worldview that stems from that. Hmm. She's traveled far from her home country and refuses to talk about her past, even with Tyrion. I think it's clear that she ran away from a bad situation back home, like, for example, an abusive family. She doesn't take the danger Tyrion warns her about seriously because, one, she's been through so much that she has an unrealistic sense of her own ability to make through anything on her own, as evidenced by the knife during the Battle of the Blackwater, which I think is good because Lee is not saying that's a sane reaction. I want to fight off literally every raping soldier that comes through those gates. It's mm-hmm. more of like a magical, like, I've got this knife and somebody's gonna come at me, I'm gonna go out stabbing kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And two, on some level, she welcomes the risk and danger and self-harm in a way that depressed, traumatized people who don't value their life very much and wants some sort of self-destructive thrill. Sorry, I had a hard time getting that sentence out. I think we're supposed to understand that Tyrion, in turn, in addition to the reasons you point out regarding his father, loves her because she is a broken thing, as he would like to say, as he says. Her defense of the younger Sansa makes sense in this context too. So, I agree with this. Like, I think that, like, you know, Tyrion says, I have a soft spot for bastards, cripples, and broken things. Mm-hmm. And Shay is kind of presenting as this broken thing. I have a visceral, like, I think it's super easy and cheap to be there in, like, big moments, like big splashy shows of affection, big speeches, or saying, like, you know, when they're, like, right here. Here's a situation where there's real disagreement. She's saying, I don't want to stay here because this, you tell me how crazy danger it is. You've lost. This isn't something you're good at. Let's get the hell out of here and do the things we are good at, drinking and fucking. And he says, I got to stay here to be happy. And instead of continuing the argument at a deeper level, which we've seen her be getting in these petty, shouty arguments all season long, yeah. She just simply said, okay, you're right. We'll do that. Like, to me... Mm-hmm. That's super easy. The hard thing is day to day, like, living with the decision you make, and that's what she's kind of sucks at.
Yeah, you're right.
But again, that's just me being annoying. That's just me being annoyed at people who have fucking damage.
Uh-huh.
And if I don't personally like the character, like, again, if they cast Roz in this and gave her a little bit more dialogue, a little bit better dialogue, I might, like, just be, like, completely fine with it. Mm-hmm. I just don't like this version of Shay.
Okay. I think you're entitled to that opinion.
I hope so. But I don't think it's universally true. Obviously, everything I've read about the Double D's and even Martin himself, they fucking love this version of the character. So, okay. Like, I'm arguing with the god of the universe when I say, uh-huh. Yeah, this Garden of Eden sucks, man. Like, why'd you make it an apple, not a pear or a pineapple? Like it's like I'm pissing up a rope, but it is my opinion, so.
Okay, there's a little bit of Varys stuff here, too. Varys essentially says we can't be friends anymore to Tyrion.
Yeah.
And takes off.
All the cool kids are going to make fun of me if I keep hanging out with you. Yeah. This scar, it's not going
to
be cool.
Pretty much. This is the transition from middle school to high school for them.
And this is essentially the speech that Varys gave to Ned. Like, yeah, I'm your friend and I like you, but I'm not going down for you.
Yeah.
Like,
I think that's just the definition of friend in King's Landing. Like, Ned didn't get that because he's not from King's Landing. Tyrion certainly does get it.
I think Varys would do something if what he could do would be effective and within his means.
Yeah. But nobody's going to stick up with you just for affection.
Like, if Varys was Jaime, he might fucking fight his way out of with the Red Keep with Tyrion in tow and set him up shop somewhere and, you know, he's not. Like, he can do what he can do, and he can't do those things if he's dead or in a prison or in the political outs.
Right.
So, I mean, long term, the best thing that Varys can do from the realm and even Tyrion is to, like, distance himself and build up his political capital and do this plan with Roz or whatever and get back on his feet, and then maybe next time he's needed, he'll be in a place where he can actually do something.
Yeah, and the gesture here of bringing Shay to him, I think, is the thing that says, look, I am actually your friend.
Totally.
But Tyrion understands all of this.
But
and that's the thing I like about
Tyrion.
It's a
bitter pill to swallow.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because Tyrion has nobody. I mean, he doesn't just come with the news that I can't be your friend, but Bronn can't be your friend.
Right.
The tribesmen have left. Nobody's your friend.
Right.
Here's the one friend you have left, Shay.
Uh-huh. And she thinks you're a mess.
Yeah, she told me, like, oh, God, his face. No. Okay, next scene. Rob marries Talisa.
Boom. There you go.
That's
boom.
The whole thing.
Yep.
I don't care to talk much about this. This is a traditional Stark wedding.
Not every day you get to see someone commit political suicide in real life.
No, it's not.
Like it's Robb Stark and Bud Dyer, right? That's the hey man, nice shot guy.
Oh, is it?
That was real and political suicide all at the same time.
Yeah, this is it's a beautiful suicide. The ceremony here is very nice, but
I wonder how many nerds do you think have had the Faith of the Seven wedding?
More than should.
Yeah.
How about that?
Like, I bet the number's in the mid-thousands.
You know, I'm not going to judge it.
I'm not going to judge it either.
I'm not going to judge it. It's do what you want. It's your fucking day.
Sure,
if
right.
both of you think, like, Game of Thrones is the awesomest thing in the world and that's what we want.
Right. Like, people throw rice at weddings. I'm not going
to
talk shit if you're...
Yeah.
I'm just saying, like, I think it's interesting that, like... It's... It says something interesting about the human race that our customs are so malleable that we can make real life vows based on fictional ones. And you know, we can throw ice, or if we're afraid of the birds' stomachs exploding, we can blow bubbles, or we can fucking do flower bombs, or whatever the hell the cool new shit is. Or we can get married to a fake religion, and that's nice.
It's fine by me. All right, Dany goes inside the House of the Undying where she hears her dragons calling out to her. This is the scene where this really cool effect of them walking around this tower and her disappearing was. Pretty short scene, though. She's just going inside without them. And then we go over to Arya and company running into Jaqen, who invites her to come back with him and learn the ways of the Faceless Men in order to start checking those names off her list. She says she can't because she needs to find her family, and so he gives her a coin and tells her, give this coin to any man from Braavos and say Valar Morghulis, and they'll take him to her. Wait, other way around. Take her to him.
Mm-hmm.
He's not leaving. He's not getting out of his chair, but they'll take her to him. And before leaving, Jaqen changes his face, which is pretty interesting.
Pretty sweet. So before we talk, keep in mind this is a non-spoiler podcast. Yep. I have to speak up for Serial Pharrell truthers.
Okay.
And that I think I detect a significant or a significant sparkle in Jaqen's eye when she mentions my water dancer is from Braavos.
He does shit all over the water dancers.
Oh, he says it's the special thing.
Yeah, it's one thing to be a water dancer, but to be a faceless man, something else entirely.
Yeah, but I feel like that could be interpreted as Yoda going from the weird Muppet who's stealing your candy bars and your flashlights to, you know, he has to being a Jedi master. I don't know. It's all from a certain point of view bullshit. And again, this is raving Cyril Ferrell truth or talk. But if you want to see some hints that maybe those two characters are connected, this combined with the fact that he just fucking changes his face at the end of the scene is some pretty bloody red meat to be thrown.
Okay.
I'm just saying.
So you're implying
that the Cyril Ferrell
is
Jack Nagar,
okay,
yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And he never died. Never died.
All right.
Did not die to that fucking oaf.
Kicked Maron Trant's ass with
any of the three steel swords from the armored soldiers he already dispatched with said wood sword.
With a stump of a wooden sword.
Just
I think
picks
he could
up
beat
a
him.
Sword off the ground and fucking hands this guy's ass, but doesn't kill him. I don't know why he doesn't kill him.
Yeah.
So his legend grows.
His name wasn't on the list.
It's Maron Trant. Sir Maron Trant is not going to be the type of guy to be like, oh yeah, the guy totally handed me his ass. He was essentially unarmed. I had a 4-to-1 advantage. I'm a King's Guardian, and he fucking handed me my ass. He's not the type of guy to volunteer the information. All right, raving truth or talk over. Cool. Do we have anything else we want to talk about the scene?
I don't know. I'm trying to ponder the logistics of anyone in Braavos getting this coin. Anyone from Braavos, not even in Braavos. Anyone from Braavos getting this coin and this phrase and knowing what to do with it? Like, what if... I can't imagine a thing that, like, oh, it's Ohioans, you know? Those Buckeye State people, you go up to them and you say... Hooday and give them a fucking Bengals cap. And they'll whisk you off to some...
And we'll give you a three-way... chili cheese spaghetti.
Right.
Plate.
A BOGO chili cheese spaghetti plate at Skyline. I don't know.
Right.
I can't imagine it, but I guess that's why it's a fictional universe.
Well, I'm trying to think of if there was this thing that it's kind of like a challenge coin that they have, and I guess it's something armed services where, you get for special things, or if you're in a certain unit, you get this thing, and then, if you present it, it can make it, in the right place or time, it gets you, a no-question answer drink, or, like Masons, that they got this, if you got a Mason ring, or you got the secret handshake, even if you don't know a person, it's this is code for, all other considerations are this. I'm now going to treat this guy like a brother for no damn good reason.
Oh, yeah, no, I understand that. But the whole point of a secret society is to be secret. And if your category is so broad as to be anyone from this place at all.
Well, maybe it's the fact that it's well known in Braavos that if you get this coin and you do this task, that you'll be handsomely rewarded.
OK,
I think it's more like that. It's kind of like that sort of deal.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it'd be cool if we had more,
We need to start one for Bald Move.
Yeah.
It'd be
The thing is you have to trust your faceless men not to hand these coins out just to any random Joe Blow, because that's how you get in trouble if the coin becomes devalued.
Right. You don't want to dilute your
no,
coin
you don't
value.
Want, you want to have a sizable reward. That's a real you don't want a plate of spaghetti with shitty cinnamon-flavored meat water poured all over it. I don't care how much cheese and onions is on it.
All right, we go to...
That's right, Cincinnati. I hate your chili. Come at me. Been living here 5 years, and I fucking hate it. All right.
Yeah, same here. So Braun and company come out from... Or Braun Bran, sorry, and company. This is why I hate these names. Mm-hmm. Bran and company come out from hiding to see Winterfell abandoned and in ruins. They find Maester Luwin dying by a weirwood tree, and he tells Bran to head north to the wall. And when the boys leave, Maester Luwin has Asha kill him. Kill him with her own knife.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what else to say about this. I kind of already, talked about what Theon said about it being around for thousands of years and getting burned in the same episode.
Yeah, it's a great scene because, I've always had a soft spot for Maester Luwin and, him doing the boys right one last time and talking about how he pulled them into this world and it's such a... pleasure and an honor to have served them. I think that was cool. And then his earnest plea to Asha to protect them. And she's even from her own kind. And she says, I don't have much love for my own kind. I'm like, that's interesting. Like, I wouldn't have suspected that from the first time we've met her.
Mm-hmm.
Then she gives him a merciful death. But that scene of them coming out into the hillside and walking out and leaving Winterfell and heading north is gorgeous. As gorgeous as any, but more forlorn than most.
Yeah.
Most time when they have those kind of like really beautiful shots, they're like some kind of awe and majesty. And this is just sad. These are two boys fleeing from their home under threat of death. And it's been set on fire by their half brother,
mm-hmm.
who turned out to be a real fucking dick.
And their mentor has been killed.
And their mentor was just killed in front of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty bad scene. And they're just boys.
Uh-huh.
They're just boys.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, one day they will realize, they'll have that moment of realization where they say, oh, shit, Maester Luwin died under that tree. You know? He wasn't going to be just fine. And I wonder when that day will be. I imagine it's probably already here for Bran, potentially.
Right.
Rickon, though, Rickon's a different story. He's pretty young.
You're right. Like, these kids are a little bit more uniquely traumatized than Arya and Sansa, because like if Arya and Sansa ever make it back to Winterfell, they're back home, right?
Yeah.
They were spared all this. But like Bran and Rickon have lived through the sack of their home and all these terrible things, and seeing people that they love and respect, like Sir Roderick and Master Luwin, and get brutalized and destroyed. Like, will it ever feel like home for them?
Yeah.
And that's kind of like, I guess, with it being on fire and them running for their lives, it kind of like hammers that point home.
Sure. All right, we go to Dany. She's still searching for her dragons, and she sees a vision of King's Landing and the throne room there in ruins with snow falling through the open ceiling.
Or perhaps ash.
It looked like snow to me. It was melting on her.
I agree, but that's if you want to get contemporary, there's a pretty raging debate about whether that was misdirection. We're supposed to understand that King's Landing was burnt up by dragons or some shit, or
because
like, you know, it's like, pick your apocalyptic future. Is it the others coming and, you know, bringing the snow, and like it's just, you got a land full of ice zombies, or is it Dany the conquering fire? Like, this is what she's gonna have to do to get the red. She's gonna have to burn it to the ground. To
I'm going with snow, since ash doesn't melt. But
did
that's
it,
just
did
me.
You see it melt?
Yeah, you can totally see it.
What, when did it melt?
On her hands, on her cloak, on her hair. You can see it
melting.
Did
they actually have a close-up of her catching one and it melting?
Not catching, but they showed close-ups of her hands, certainly, and the ice or snow melting.
Okay. Well, then those ash people need to fuck right off.
Yeah.
I need to go back 5 years, record that podcast, and say, fuck off. We got melting snow. Ash doesn't melt.
But like you said, maybe it's a misdirection. So she hears dragons calling and walks through a gate, which leads her north of the wall. She finds a tent there, which contains Drogo and her baby, and she is enormously glad to see them, but realizes it's not real. So she goes to look for her dragons, and she finds them in a chamber where the purple-lipped guy binds her in shackles. Fortunately, her dragons incinerate the warlock, and she's released from her imprisonment.
Maybe they should have split this up with, like, a couple other scenes. Because, just all this happens, and it feels like it's... Like, I was really getting into the different visions she was seeing, and then she walks out of the tent, and that's it, and then it instantly resolves, and we're like half, we still have, you know, we're at the, what, two-third mark
of
the episode?
It did feel like an ending for an episode, certainly.
Right.
Yeah.
And maybe they had just a lot of fucking, because, like, you know, there's a lot of beats where, like Arya, like you go to the previous scene of Arya with Jaqen. Like, that's so damn exciting, the idea of, like, Arya becoming this little murder machine.
Yep.
This secret, that could have been the end of the episode. The boys with the forlorn Stark music leaving Winterfell could have been the end episode. Uh-huh. Dracarys, if they gussied it up a little bit more, could have been an end of an episode. Maybe they just had too many awesome things to pick from.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty much the end of the episode from here to the end.
Right. Because that's the other thing. Is like, I'm going to say the same thing about this half-end episode. This also felt rushed and kind of shittier than it should have been.
Huh. Okay. Yeah, let's talk about it. Ygritte's taunting Jon, and he starts taunting back. They're continuing their ruse, and Corrin comes to Jon with a sword. Lord of Bones, or whatever his name is, lets them fight, and Jon kills Corrin. They untie John, and Ygritte takes him to a cliff where she shows him an encampment where the king beyond the wall awaits their arrival.
And there's so many people.
Lots of them, yeah.
Lots, that's like a bunch.
Yeah, well, we know he's unifying the North, you know? He's the king of the North, or king beyond the wall, rather.
Yeah.
He needs an army.
I mean, so you haven't read the books. You don't know any of the backstory here. You don't know how, like, it quote-unquote should have gone down. What did you think of, like, the John and Halfhand plot? Like, I felt like there was a little bit unsaid and a little bit, like, no, the John didn't really have any agency here. Like, this, mm-hmm. Halfhand guy is going to play fight him until he finally kills him.
Yeah.
Like, what is so, like, there wasn't. It felt less like a noble, like this hard, difficult task that John is accepting, and like, well, shit, you know.
Yeah, I struggle to come up with a better way to do it though, because they can't exactly have just a conversation. Right?
Yeah, the other thing I didn't like is essentially John being goaded into kill. Like there was like genuine anger and like, I want you to die at the end. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. I mean, you got to sell it, right? But, like, I sure. felt like they made erred on the side of, like, maybe that's effective because, like, you know, there is this seduction that's happening. John mm-hmm. sees some aspects of the wildling culture that he likes, namely their redheads. And, you know, chafing under, like, some of the rules and risks. Like, this season's been about him being disillusioned with the Night's Watch, going all the way back to Craster offering up his children and the bear being like, yeah, well, real politic, mm-hmm. you know. Crack a book sometime, John. You gotta break some eggs to make an omelet. And leading up to this, I don't know. I can't tell if it's good or bad, or it just was, again, just like the Danny scene, it needed a little bit more time to breathe. Maybe this should have been like a 90-minute episode.
Maybe. I did feel like it was a little bit longer than a typical episode.
Might have been.
I could be wrong about that.
Might have been. But like I said, Ned's, a lot of these scenes just felt like it needed a beat or two more, or like punctuate, like split it up so it's like you could give people enough time to kind of process things. But I don't know.
Yeah, I think I'm with you on this one. Corin, I don't know. I mean, Corin, like you said, isn't giving John a choice in this, but also, John isn't the kind of person who wants to kill him. I mean, shit, right. He didn't even want to kill Ygritte, right?
Right.
So he's got to do something. There's got to be some way to get John to kill him.
Sure.
And if that way is to anger him and then make him remorseful afterward,
right?
But understand why Corin did it, I think that works. That's okay. It's just something that I think is going to take a little while for John to process.
Yeah. The other thing is, a lot of these things feeling rushed and cramped as a direct result to just narrow in the focus to Blackwater. And that's what made that episode awesome.
Yeah.
Like, if we were cutting away from the Blackwater to get Dany and going around in circles in the House of the Undying, or Corin giving, you know, John his marching orders, like, it wouldn't have been as effective. So, like, the choice to make Nine that kind of centerpiece around the Blackwater had to steal some of the oxygen from the room in these scenes. Mm-hmm. So, like, I don't know. Like, I'm not a showrunner. I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. I just feel like that they're, I always wish they could have done things a little bit better, especially on big things like, you know, Dany having her little seasonal moment of awesome, and John, you know, really struggling for what it means to be a watcher on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, but the important thing is the wildlings are suitably impressed. You know, Corin Halfhand is one of their big Baba Yagas, their big John Wick boogeyman. So this guy killing them, and the way that the thing I did enjoy is, like, all of the things that Corin Halfhand has been saying are stuff that, like, would make the wildlings sit up and take notice. Like, oh, his father's a traitor? So he's like bucking against the system, and his mother's a whore. This is no lord that's going to be too high and mighty and be too nicey. Like, it's exactly what they need to hear to start thinking that maybe John would betray his oaths, mm-hmm. which is what he needs. You know, like Corin said two episodes ago, we need a person on the inside. You'll be worth 1,000 men. You being on the inside is worth 1,000 men on the other side of the wall. So
right.
It does work. It just doesn't work as well as I hoped it would.
Okay, let's move on to Duck Sauce, who is sleeping when Danny comes in and catches him with her handmaiden. Oh, man.
Doria, what are you doing?
Takes both of them to the vault.
You're doing the Duck Sauce is what you're doing.
She is, certainly. She takes both of them over to the vault, which is empty, by the way, and locks them in. Then the Dothraki pillage all the gold and jewels from the city to buy a small ship. A small ship. I guess this is just Duck Sauce's house, but...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Danny's handmaiden sold her out.
I always liked that scene when a person, like, you can tell that she had all her reasons of why this was a good thing, and like, but now Danny's Daenerys is standing in front of you, and you're like, oh, I fucked up. I'm gonna get locked in this vault, and there's nothing.
Yeah, we called it. Nothing in that vault. She should have checked that vault from day one if she was ever even going to consider this. A lot of empty promises in this episode.
Yep.
Melisandre, Duck Sauce.
But that's the thing is, like, I felt like this scene was exactly the right length because it's not like we were super emotionally involved in Zorro. We suspected the thing about his treasure. It's just like a really stone cold way to kill somebody for breaking your word, and then and then you're out.
And also, all the golden jewels.
It also kind of makes the. It makes the Dothraki wanting to pillage the guy's house but funnier in retrospect because they eventually got their wish.
Yep. They just had to wait a little while.
Yep.
So we're back to the north, and Sam tells his friends that he's interested in Gilly because she stays positive, unlike them. And they hear a horn blow not once, not twice, three times.
Thrice!
Which is pretty rare. And a storm approaches. Sam isn't fast enough to escape, so he hides as a buttload of whites stroll past him. Then a White Walker sees him, but he doesn't seem to care too much. He's on another mission.
His face looks like a series of just stitched together buttholes.
Yeah.
He's
got a puckered
face.
His
face, nose, mouth, and eyes just look like a bunch of chocolate star, like frosted starfish. Mm-hmm. Not chocolate, they're frosted. interesting look.
It is. They're shouting something. I mean, it's completely unintelligible,
right?
But
it's like a shriek,
making some weird noise that seems to be pushing these whites forward.
And yet again, they leave one man alive to tell the tale.
Yeah. I'm not sure why exactly.
I think we don't know their motivation. I think it's a terror tactic, like, because it's consistent with what they did in the first. Like, they could have run that guy down and killed him, but they wanted. It feels like they want the realms of men to know.
Yeah.
Like, we are coming for you. Shit yourself.
Here's the plan, then.
Uh-huh.
Fight the White Walkers one at a time. Just send one man in. He'll be a one-man wrecking crew.
They gotta send two. Because if there's no one, if you know what I'm saying, like, if you just send one, they'll kill him because there's no way to...
They didn't kill Sam.
Yeah, but there's no tail to tail. It's like you come up, you look at the White Walker, and he kind of shrugs, and you turn around and walk back. It's like, so tell us the tale of the White Walker. They just shrugged at me and I walked off.
That's what I mean.
You gotta have
Why
two
wouldn't they kill
so
him?
They can brutally kill the one guy and then let the other guy sneak back.
Okay.
You're right. You're talking about a way to defeat. I was thinking of like what's optimum for the White Walkers.
No, I'm thinking you a way to defeat the White Walkers. Just one at a time. But yeah. Where are they going? You have any idea?
The largest ranging party in recent memory is at the Fist of the First Men. So I'm assuming that they are they're going there.
Okay,
going there to what must be just a massive awesome battle, like all these Night's Watchmen versus like this huge crowd of the dead.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's gonna be fucking sweet when we come back for it in season three.
It could be if they do it right.
We'll see.
All right. That's the end of the episode.
Hey, if you've enjoyed our coverage of Game of Thrones, and there's a lot of it. There's a lot of coverage of Game of Thrones, and I think we do a pretty good job of it.
I've enjoyed it.
You know, we wouldn't have gotten a season two retrospective recap had we not done this as full-time jobs, because we barely have enough time to do it even as full-time podcasters.
That's true.
So if you really enjoyed this podcast and you want to keep stuff like this going and contribute to the success of baldmove.com, go to our club page. Just check it out. If you haven't checked it out, check it out. Go to club.baldmove.com. Because there's a pitch for every single feature there, and it's a link to actual samples where you can actually see what you get for your club membership. When you sign up, you get 30 days to try it for free, so that's cool. This week, there's two pieces of club content coming out, our Wolf Among Us playthrough, which I talked about in the housekeeping section, and the spoiler-filled movie review of the Justice League. Everyone gets the free spoiler-not-filled, non-spoiler review of the general thoughts of the movie, but if you want to hear us really talk about the finer points of The Flash and Cyborg and Wonder Woman and Batman and Superman, he's dead. Superman won't be
in
the Justice League. He's dead. No? He's dead. And one thing they're not going to do is bring Superman back to
Definitely
life.
Definitely not. No.
They're not going to do that. If you want to hear that stuff, you got to be a club member. Club.baldmove.com. Again, check that link out. See what we've got to offer. See if any of the things are pertinent to your interests. And we could really use your support. Club.baldmove.com.
Do we have some feedback to do?
Oh boy, we do. I think people are feeling this is the last time, so they got their piece in.
Uh-oh.
First up, Scott V. Like to hear a discussion on the timing of our season 3 coverage. So we
don't know.
I know.
We don't, please.
But he's like,
please, I don't know.
I heard you want to do it before season 8 airs. He's throwing in like we should wait until after season 8 airs to do season 3.
Look, man, we made a promise. We made a vow. our oath was we would do it before season 8.
Here's the thing. I don't even think it's about that. It's like we have on multiple shows and over the course of many years done situations like this. And what we found out is once a show is over,
yeah,
like, again, there'll be diehards, but a lot of the casual fans just decamp. And that's assuming that season 8 is going to be like a rousing good time and like, you know, just like a very fulfilling. Like, what if season 8 lays a big fat, you know, goose egg?
Then
people are going to be heading for the hills. Nobody's going to want to stick around for, you know, an enjoyment of season 3, which might be one of the best seasons of all time, Game of Thrones. So like, I think it's the safe play to do it this way.
This way being season 3 before
doing eight. Somewhere before season 8. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because if we wait till afterwards and it's a disaster, that's going to suck. And then even if it's not, then people are like, you know, they'll have their fill of Game of Thrones and they'll go elsewhere.
You know, this got me thinking. I have a conspiracy theory.
Oh, yeah?
And it's just a conspiracy between HBO and themselves.
Right.
But do you think they're maybe delaying the release of season 8 so that they can develop and film and release the whatever spinoff show they're going to be doing?
I wouldn't be surprised if
and capture the audience
be surprised
they have before
if
it falls
if,
off.
I don't know about that, but I wouldn't be surprised if they want to delay it to where development's far enough along for them to have a really fucking sweet trailer they can show during season 8.
Right.
And if but
because they've got to capture those eyeballs, otherwise.
Yeah. Although I do, I mean, do they got to? Because like, if this
I think
is,
so,
the sequels or prequels or whatever the hell they are going to be the biggest news. Like, you're not going to be able to escape attention. They're going
right,
to be
but
on
I think
Entertainment
this...
Weekly, and they're going to be on billboards, and they're going to be on fucking First Look with
Absolutely,
Marina.
But you have to get people hyped while they're hyped. Hyped for your new thing while they're hyped for your old thing. Otherwise, there's a chance that you'll lose
That's
a
true.
Lot of them because it's a perfect time to check out. Like, say, I spent 8 years with Game of Thrones.
Right.
I'm happy with it, but I don't really want to go on a new journey with that.
But, oh, shit, here's Robert's Rebellion, and gods, he was strong
right.
back then. And,
right.
You know, it's Bobby B. hype, and it's,
I
yeah.
certainly think it's a better idea to do that than to wait until
yeah.
after it's over.
Yeah. And that's the thing, like, I guess because what we haven't done before is just randomly drop a season of coverage completely divorced from every other. Like, you know, when we did Breaking Bad,
sure.
we did it right after. And the thing is, like, releasing it in, like, a very low energy part of the fan base, like, where we're, it's far enough away that we're not really excited about season 8.
Yeah.
Or it's so far past season 7, everybody's unsubscribed. Like, we could be hurting our audience somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. Like, I mean, basically, we've gotten really good success in the first two seasons of coverage. And if season 3 is nothing but just saying we have complete coverage so we can be one of those podcasts that says, hey, cradle to grave, we got you on the show, that still has value to us, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe, like, in an ideal world, I'd know season 8 was coming enough in advance that we could do it, like, in the lead up before.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, like, I don't think we had 10 weeks notice for season 7. when we actually got the. And if you fuck that up, then what are you going to do? Anyway, like I said, basically, Scott, we're trying to do it the best way we can. So, like, we are trying to take in all considerations. Let's move on. Corey P., I'm going back and I'm rewatching while listening to your podcast in between. On a season 10 episode, season 1 episode, man, season 10's really caught my imagination.
Yes.
That's why they're delaying, because it turns out there's going to be two more seasons.
Oh, shit.
Corey P. has a question. The Tullys married off two daughters to the Lord's Paramount. But the question is, why? Why were the Riverlands so important during Robert's Rebellion, which is when I assume their betrothal began, that caused the Tullys to hold so much power? So what he's referring to is Lysa got married off to John Arryn, who's the Lord Paramount of the Vale.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, Kat got married off to first Brandon Stark, the elder brother of Ned. But when he got killed, got married off to Ned.
Mm-hmm.
Why would this house be so relatively powerful? And I guess the real noodle bender here is that the Riverlands are one of the weaker houses, period, because they didn't even start until the Conquest. So they go back 300 years when Aegon the Conqueror came and destroyed Harrenhal. That's where the Harrenhal used to be the seat where the Iron Islanders controlled all of the Riverlands and the Iron Islands. Harrenhal was destroyed, and the Tullys were one of the first of the houses to declare for Aegon. So he made them Lord Paramount of the Riverlands as a way to pay them back. So they are a recently kind of like a upstart house similar to the Tyrells further south. So the real question is why, and they're always historically been weak because the Riverlands is like the meat in the aggression sandwich that happens every couple generations in Game of Thrones. They're literally like, if you want to go north and march south, you got to trample on the Riverlands. If you want to go east and march west, you're going to trample on the Riverlands. And also, to add another delicious piece of meat in this shitty stew, is a lot of their bannermen have been fighting generational long wars against each other.
No, boy.
So, like, you've got this fraction, and you got the Frey, that's one of his bannermen's, the Frey. You got these fractious and distrustful and disloyal bannermen. You're right in the middle of the continent getting assaulted on all sides. The very smart householder would try to keep that from happening. The other thing is, Kat is one of the beauties of her time. Like, Catelyn Stark, you're supposed to understand, is as beautiful as any woman in Westeros has ever been. Like, she's right up there with Cersei. So that, you know, and you know, lords, all other things being equal, like to marry their successful sons off to very beautiful women so they can have beautiful grandchildren.
Of course.
Which are then further pawns in their political game.
Of course.
You have good-looking sons and daughters, and that's the... So, essentially, that's what happened. He was trying to cement a relationship up north and to the east so he could secure as many of his borders as he could. They don't really... I mean, when I did research, most people took pains to point out how weak the Tullys are. So I don't have an answer of like how relatively strong they are, but they are, you know, they are a great house that has access to a lot of great lands and wealthy lands. So they're not nothing. They're just not as well politically established as the Starks or the Lannisters. Tully was trying to marry off one of his daughters. He's trying to marry off Lysa to Jaime. And it got foiled because King Aerys made Jaime Kingsguard, which made all that null and void. So they could even, like, imagine that. You could have had married to the Starks and the Lannisters. That would have been a tough – that would have made the rebellion even harder to side for. All right, Connor H., you guys have been shitting all season long about how easy it is for the Warlocks to pull that coup in season 2 on Karth, but you seem to forget that they said that their magic gets more powerful around dragons. I don't think anyone on Karth has seen them pull the shit that they're pulling with this crazy magic. Fair point.
Yeah. They mentioned that in this episode.
Right.
That the dragons are back, our magic got stronger.
Probably why Connor is mentioning it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a fair point. If you had this uneasy alliance of these 13 unconnected wise rulers or whatever, and then one of them gets nukes, mm-hmm. then obviously that's going to change things. Danny and her dragons could be those could have powered them up. So I think you're onto something there, Connor. I'll slightly retract. The ease in which the King of Karth and the Warlocks were able to take control. We have one last spoiler-free email. Jack W. says, you guys were talking about Stannis leading the charge in order to inspire his men, not worrying about arrows, etc. But I think you missed out on one key thing. He genuinely believed that he had divine protection. Melisandre had him convinced that he was the prince who was promised and meant to win the battle, thus him not worrying about arrows or rocks falling on his head. That's a super good point, which was banged home this episode, that like some of his fearlessness and recklessness was just like, I'm going to win no matter what, so fuck it.
Yeah.
Hundreds of men will die, thousands, but I'll still be victorious. And he almost was. Mm-hmm. Almost was. That's it for the spoiler-free feedback. We are not doing a season wrap-up, right? Someone said that we've done one for season one. But I think we're breaking tradition and not doing one for season two.
Yeah, yeah. We have a lot of concerns at the moment. Uh-huh. A lot of concerns on the table. So, yeah,
unlike
Varys,
we have many irons in the fire. We're not trying to look to get into more. So yeah, this will be it. And I think we got a lot of we've talked about Game of Thrones for 20 weeks
damn
running.
Near.
So
pretty
I think we're ready to put it to bed for a season, possibly an entire year.
Yeah.
Well, no, we'll get it. We'll take it back. We'll take season three off and dust it off and take it off the shelf and get into it before season eight. I mean, that's what we just said.
Yeah, that's the plan.
So it won't be a whole year. We'll be back.
Or we'll wait till 2026 and we'll be back with
season three. No, veto. Yeah. Not going to do that.
We'll do it when the time is right.
when HBO announces the remake of Game of Thrones, right. We'll wait till that third season and say, fuck it. No one will notice.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you want to follow us along on that, check out baldmove.com. Subscribe to one of our many social media feeds, so you can just stay subscribed to this feed in your podcast aggregator. And then if we drop an episode, you'll be ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
So we will see you when we see you. We still got a little bit of spoiler stuff to talk about. I think it's time for us to get into there.
All right,
get in there and see what's up with the spoilers.
Let's do it.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
madman and father of Mad Max, George Miller, is back with another apocalyptic tale from the Australian wastelands.
This time, we're getting a prequel featuring the origin story of Charlize Theron's character, Furiosa. Starring the Queen's Gambit's Anya Taylor-Joy in the title role, and the mighty Thor, Chris Hemsworth, as the warlord, Dr. Dementis, Furiosa promises more high-octane, slightly radioactive action and fun.
Furiosa drives into theaters on May 24th, and we'll have our spoiler-free thoughts and impressions of the film, as well as a discussion of trailers and upcoming movies for everyone. But if you want to ride with us the full length of the podcast on the eternal highways of Valhalla, shiny and chrome, you're going to have to be a club member.
Join today at support.baldmove.com. Get our full discussion of Furiosa and many more first-run films, plus tons of other bonus podcasts and ad-free feeds.
Support.baldmove.com.
Okay, it's spoiler time. I hope everybody who doesn't want to hear it is out of the room.
Can you believe we really only had 1.5 Where Are My Dragons this season?
Yeah, it's pretty shocking. I would have guessed a number a lot bigger than that.
Yeah, like I feel like the promos and Emilia Clarke doing the YouTube thing, like they just really leaned into it, and it became like this cultural thing where, like, yeah, she's just screaming about dragons the whole time. And also, yeah. I think it's a reaction to the relatively unsatisfying nature of her arc this season. It's just she didn't get anything she needed. Yeah. She was just kind of put in the fridge for a year, mm-hmm. because she didn't. She gets this one lame little ship, and that's it. That's mm-hmm. it. It's just, and that ship is going to get her to their next destination, and then she'll sit there for a couple seasons.
Yeah,
until she gets to her next destination, she'll sit there for a season or two until she comes to Westeros, where mm-hmm. she'll sit in Dragonstone for yet another season. And
I can see why people are dissatisfied with her arc.
Yeah, yeah. Where is my Danny? That's what I want to know. What do you want to talk about? Like, the thing Theon should have taken the black.
Yeah,
knowing
totally,
what we
absolutely.
Know that Theon's yes. going to go through. He
and he has a moment where he considers it, right? Until
yeah.
he remembers, oh, John's up there.
And that's the thing, like, no, like, the hilarious thing for extra dramatic irony is not only does he lose Winterfell, not only does he lose his pillar and stones, not only does he have to eventually, not only does he lose everything, but he eventually has to face the thing that he fears worst, which is John looking him in the eye and saying, you're a piece of shit.
Yep.
And John, after everything, eventually forgave him. So,
yeah,
like, that,
I think that's a very different John than the John we have now, too, right?
Because, well, I mean,
John takes a long journey as well, which changes him.
It's almost like you're saying everything had to happen. It had to happen.
No, I'm just saying, like, if it had happened,
you don't,
in,
so you don't
in
think John
three,
would have, you don't think John would have ever forgiven him?
I don't know about ever. I don't think he would have if he showed up season 3, episode 2 at the wall.
It
no.
also depends on what kind of, like, because I feel like Theon with his pillar and stones intact would have been one of the Moletown horrors.
Yeah.
That would have really gotten John's goat.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, maybe that Theon is not humble enough to actually, because, yeah, I guess what I'm saying is, like, Theon could have saved himself a lot of trouble had he just gone to the black, because eventually John did forgive him. But John forgave him largely because of the journey he took and the journey Theon took. So
yeah,
it's almost like if things are different, they won't be the same. Do you have any...
Almost
have,
like it. What do you make of this melting snow? Because I swear the snow is melting on her.
I'll go
like,
along
there are
with
like
you.
Flakes that hit her guard or whatever.
I always
her,
thought
her
it was supposed
plate.
To be snow. I always thought this was... Because in the books, she sees a whole slew of visions. And mm-hmm. some stuff, in retrospect, might have given away the ghost too much. Like, she's at a wedding feast and there's a man of honor who is got his throat slit and there's a wolf head sitting on his shoulders.
Yep. Okay.
Like,
that's
you can do things in a book where, like, you know, everyone uses their imagination, but if you actually showed, like, how would you show that and not have people like, oh my God, this is going to be, the Rob's fucked.
Yeah.
Rob, don't go to your wedding, Rob, you know, it's going to, well, it's not Rob's, but it's Edmure's wedding.
Right.
Cause we just saw Rob's. But there's a lot of stuff. There's, like, this, like, premonition of Jon, like, the one of the earliest indications of Jon Snow is a secret Targaryen, an Aegon Targaryen, if you will, was that Danny sees like a blue winter rose growing out of a chink of an ice in an ice wall, and that blue rose was previously in the previous books used to kind of represent Lyanna Stark. And so, like, this was one of, and it was tied to, like, her ancestors. This is where she gets the prophecies about, like, the Mummer's Dragon and like, lots of different prophecies regarding Daenerys that the show has largely kind of ignored. Like, the one thing that the show seems to have leaned into from the beginning was this Miri Maz Duer prophecy about the sun setting in the east and setting in east and rising in the west and all that stuff. I forget how did we get on that.
I guess I'm just surprised that it's not brought up more when you start talking about, like, oh, maybe it's Ash.
Yeah.
Because it seemed instantly recognizable as Snow to me, but I don't know. I mean, there has to be something. Snow doesn't take out the ceiling of the castle of the throne room, you know.
Right.
So there's got to be something else involved.
Right.
The snow is probably just a representation of the White Walkers coming south.
Right.
Which, if they get that far south, you know, that's bad news for the north.
Right. Right. And that's what I'm saying. Like, I always thought the snow was like the, a warning that if you don't do things right, this is what's going to happen. And I guess I could have used a lot more House in the Undying action, honestly, because that's what in the books she sees, like, she's essentially got, like, things that are warnings and things that are temptations. And I feel like they did one of each and then that's it. I felt like there should have been several cycles and Dany really struggling with, like, freeing her mind from this trap that they've put her in. And instead they put all the emphasis on her dragons destroying the warlock. Which also happens in the books. It's just like in the books, your imagination can you know, kind of run wild and make it seem cooler than these little scrawny CGI dragons with their pitiful jets of flame.
Yeah.
It just, I don't know. What else do we want to talk about?
I don't know. I'm still thinking about that scene. I mean, they have an ice dragon now, so that could definitely do some damage to the top of that castle.
What castle are we talking about?
King's Landing, the throne room.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So, yeah. I don't know. That could be the fate.
Or it could be Cersei goes wild and knocks over a brazier while she's drunk on the wine that she's drinking and just sets the Red Keep on fire.
Well, I think it'd be an interesting sort of a poetic justice sort of thing where Dany doesn't want to attack King's Landing with her dragons, but now she's lost a dragon, which is used to attack King's Landing, she might get blamed for it.
In like an irony kind of way.
Yeah. I don't know. We'll see. But that's about all I have on spoilers.
Okay, well, let's get through the feedback then.
Okay.
Megan H., what was the deal with the way the siege played out with Theon getting knocked out and his men leaving? A book reader friend of mine tells me there was a deal that anyone who surrenders could live, with the exception of Theon. Was there something in the show that signals this and I just spaced out, or is this info we get later? Or never?
No, I think it's just implied.
Did the
honestly.
Boltons actually honor this, or are all the Iron Islanders who left now dead? I think yes, they do imply this is the deal, but also you can also think that, like, well, Theon is just being abandoned by these craven thieves, and which is kind of what you'd expect from the Iron Islanders. They're not going to fight for a doomed cause because why?
Sure. And you could maybe say, oh, during their searching for Bran, they might have found some passageways that Luwin was talking about. Maybe they're just going to leave.
I honestly don't remember. I don't think because there is a scene where I think they take Moat Cailin or something like that, and Ramsay does promise some safe passage, and then he just kills and flays them all anyway.
Yep.
That's certainly a Ramsay thing to do, but I don't think we get there in this season. Like, I think Theon wakes up in the Dreadfort and things go from there.
I mean, Ramsay takes his liberties, you know, more and more as the seasons go on. I think right now. He very much, like, wants to impress his father, right?
Right.
And so he's sent in to take Winterfell. That's what he does.
Yep.
And I don't think he's that interested in flaying people yet.
She says, I also thought it was interesting that Maester Luwin was counseling Theon to take the black as a means of repentance and doing good with his life. I was thinking that could be a satisfying ultimate end for Theon, though I guess, depending on how the series wraps up, there may be no more need for a Night's Watch. That's an interesting idea, to the fact that he can take the black retrospectively.
Mm-hmm.
Final side note, you said that the Blackwater podcast, that the Hound isn't a knight, or so that blonde dude wouldn't be a squire. Isn't he a sir or a sare in the Game of Thrones world? I know the Mountain is Sir Gregor, and also Gregor fought in that jousting competition or whatever. It was called at the beginning of season one. So is Gregor a knight, but not Sandor?
Yeah. I know Gregor is, yeah.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons Sandor is so has such a fucked up view of knights, because, like, fucking my brother is an anointed knight sworn to uphold this code of chivalry and bullshit.
Yeah, and he's a huge shitbag.
Now, you don't have to be a knight to fight in a tournament.
Right.
And, you know, again, there's like this, there's north-south kind of split that the northerners don't really do a lot of siring, although there's not a prohibition. Sir Roderick was the master at arms at Winterfell and a pretty high-ranking person in the Stark household, yet he styled himself as a sir. He had been gone through the knighting process, which involves...
What was his religious affiliation? Because I think that's a religious sort of thing,
it
right?
It is. It really is. It's, I mean, I don't know if you can... Because, like, people swear by the old gods and the new.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't think it's, like, a scandalous thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I imagine Sir Roderick got a lot of ribbing about being like, oh, let me get the door for you, sir, because, like, in Northerners, like, just don't give a shit. It's like it's seen as like taking on an heir to them. But I think that's it for Megan. Dan from Florida is curious. In the final scene where Jack and Hagar first changes his face in front of Arya, could either of you tell whether he's putting a face on or taking it off? Because now that we know how faces work, is there anything we can take away from this scene in terms of who Jaqen really is? Of these two faces, which was his real one? Was either? Does it even matter? Will we see him in season 8? Holy shit, that's a lot of curiosity.
That is, and I applaud you for being a curious person.
I thought the same fucking thing. When he turned it, there was a little move, and I'm like, is he putting on or is he taking off?
I don't know. I didn't look. I was not considering that, and I didn't look that closely.
I would say that neither. I mean, I guess the safe money is that neither of those are his true faces, because on a mission, why the fuck? Why the fuck would he wear his real face?
Yeah. Certainly, the Jaqen face, as we've come to know it, is how he represents himself to Arya most of the time.
Right.
And it's only kind of in these grand gestures where he changes into a different person
right.
for her. So I think you can somewhat safely assume that that might be his real face, but you're right. Why ever use that, especially in the land of the enemy?
In fact, I got this is nothing that's in the actual canon, but my headcanon says that a true faceless man might not even like if you get as indoctrinated into the cult as they want you to be, you might not even remember your original face.
Sure, yeah.
Like, you just wear, like, whatever face I need is the wear I'm wearing, and, like, that's what I'm comfortable in, because I'm no one. I'm literally no one.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, like, that makes the faceless man have, like, that name actually means something then.
Yeah, it's a brainwashing sort of akin to what Theon goes through.
Right.
You know?
And in the books, we never see Jaqen again. We see this face, this what they call, like, the alchemist face, because he shows up later at the Citadel when Sam shows up there and he's doing some kind of thing there.
Hmm.
But when Arya goes to Braavos, she never sees Jaqen.
Really?
Yeah, there's this old, they call him the kindly man because they don't have any names, and they've got the waif.
Okay.
But, and they even do that in this, like, the kindly man eventually morphs into Jaqen, but that's not in the books at all.
Huh.
Apparently that's Sam's surprising. Sam's came and gone at the Citadel with nary a Jaqen to be seen, so
nope.
Make of that what you will.
Or a sand snake.
Or a sand snake, yep. Tessie. All right, this may be a half-baked theory, but I was listening to an old season 4 podcast on a tinfoil theory of yours, and it got me thinking. I think she's referring to the Dany and the House of the Undying. I did a whole deep dive on this back in season 4. Most of Miri Mazdur's prophecy about Dany has come true. We've seen the Dornish sun come from west to east in the form of Quentin. The Dothraki Sea dry up in the winter, which is the Dothraki Sea, of course, the grass sea that turns brown towards the end of Dance of Dragons. And the mountain, Sir Gregor, fall, sort of. So doesn't that mean we'll get the resultant end of the theory? We saw Dany and Jon get it on at the end of Season 7 with so much talk of how she couldn't or could get pregnant. I would expect that she's going to be pregnant sometime in Season 8, but what about Drogo returning? What if Danny dies and goes to the Shadowlands and sees Drogo again? It would be even more exactly fitting to prophecy if she died in childbirth, which is not a strange phenomenon in the world. That's a good question, because a lot of the fan theory crafting concerns whether she can perhaps conceive children or not, not that Drogo would literally return from the dead, even though that's just as much of the prophecy as anything. So what do you think?
Man, I'm not versed in the prophecy well enough.
I think
really
you're versed well enough to know that, like, do you think Drogo's going to come back from the dead? What if Drogon dies? Like, is Drogon a good enough stand-in for Drogo that him coming back to life in some miraculous way would fulfill the tenets of the prophecy? Because you also got Rhaegal. Maybe. This is all bound up, and I don't think Danny wants a zombie family coming back to life.
Yeah, I don't know. This is all Nostradamus shit to me, man. Like,
right.
I'm going to say a lot of shit, and then when stuff happens that kind of fits it, I'm going to point at it and say, see?
Well, I think it's interesting that Danny's got two remaining dragons. One's Drogon, and one is Rhaegal, which is a name, like, is named for her brother, and also... There was a nod to that the name she gave her actual son that died during the delivery process, the dark magic. It would be kind of interesting if she's able to bear children and her dragons are returned to her, but again, that's not the exact wording of the prophecy. And
that's what I mean by not well versed enough. I don't know the exact wording.
I mean, she just about quoted it. The sun rising from this, the mountains, the sea drying up, the mountains fall. That's when Drogo will return, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
I mean, I just was saying, like, there's really not that much to it. Like, there's a couple more flowery words, but there's really not much.
Gotcha.
I guess my thing is, I would be dismissive of the whole thing, except for this is the one prophecy that the show has consistently hammered home, and Dany herself talked about it in season 7.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be weird if nothing came of that.
Sure. Yeah, I feel you. As so many of these other prophecies have, you know, gone off the tracks in various ways, and are, I guess, still fulfillable from a certain point of view.
Right.
But there needs to be, in my mind, if I were writing this, I would say there need to be multiple prophecies, which there are, and some of them need to be fulfilled and some of them shouldn't be fulfilled simply because you don't want, like, the prophecy to just be written in stone and say, this is going to happen because there's a prophecy. You want to cast some doubt on prophecy, and I think you want to do so right up till the very end and beyond the end. I think you want there to be prophecy left in doubt or prophecy left completely unfulfilled by the end of this thing, such as, like, Melisandre's prophecies, right?
Right, yeah, and that strikes to the heart of a perennial question, which is, is there any intelligent supernatural force in Game of Thrones universe? Because if magic is just like an elemental force that has no will or intelligence, then these gifts of prophecy can be misinterpreted.
Sure.
You can have charlatans just making shit up. And Melisandre is interesting because she does both. But if you come down to decide that there is, like, an intelligence, then a lot of the prophecy has to be true, because if you got these supernatural godly powers that are calling shots and then, like, whoops, couldn't fucking cover that one, then, like, what the fuck? I mean, I guess you could start...
Unless we're all in the, you know, the chess game of the gods, right?
Right, and there's multiple gods playing against each other, and they're not all powerful and all knowing. They got relative, like, there's a lot of wiggle room, but I guess, like, these kind of questions get at that heart. Like, if all prophecies come true, then it's kind of like, well, QED. If half the prophecies come true, then it's like, I guess that's the more interesting question.
It certainly would be to me as a writer, but I'm not writing this, so who knows?
Indeed. Well, neither is George Martin. So
nobody's writing it at this point.
There's no one's hand at the wheel, which means all of our hands are at the wheel. Chase G.
The double D's got a prophecy that this thing will get done somehow, and they're just hands off the wheel at this point.
They're the princes that were promised.
Yeah.
They came to kill the hype slayer George Martin and fulfill his duties unto us. Chase G. In the Blackwater episode, Varys informs Tyrion that having Stannis on the Iron Throne would be disastrous for the realm, because he has taken up with the Red Priestess and now follows the Lord of Light and has used these dark powers to secure his military strength.
Agreed.
Obviously has a deep disdain for dark magic, as explained in the story of how he was cut.
Me too.
I wonder what this means for his current allegiance to Dany and her alliance with Jon Snow. Mm. Wouldn't he see Jon as a byproduct of something dark and evil from his perspective? Is it even confirmed that Melisandre's actions are what brought back Jon to life, or would he have come back regardless? What are your thoughts on this, or do you think Varys gets much plot in the final episodes? No way can they shunt Varys off to a secondary role.
How much does Varys know? Is he doesn't have his spy network anymore, right?
It's starting to come back together.
Okay. Is he privy to all of the information? Like, does he know that Jon has been resurrected by Melisandre?
I don't think he knows. I don't think, because, like, even, I don't think Dany fully understood what was going on until she saw the scars on his chest, because there was a significant look where she's like, holy fuck, you got these giant holes all over your body.
So we're playing the hypothetical game of if he finds out,
yeah,
what does he think of that?
Right.
I think it would raise his eyebrows, certainly.
And it's interesting because we think that Dany has a traitor in her midst.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right about the eyebrow raising. I wonder if one of the things Varys is going to do in season 8 is betray Dany.
Because he finds out.
Or he's just hedging John's his bets. Cool. Like, you know what? He's already like on high alert for her turning into the Mad Queen.
Mm-hmm.
And now she's shacking up with this undead conqueror.
Yeah.
And he starts to get too. And like, I could see us entirely understanding him doing the things he's doing, but he's still going to burn because, you know, that's what Dany said. And also, Melisandre said, by the time we're both going to die in this country. Like, those are. Like Melisandre and Varys dying are two of the sure bets if prophecy is real in this world, right? Because we just got that this season.
Yep.
And that would be an interesting way for Varys to actually be, again, in his mind, all justified. Maybe even some people watching the show would agree, but you kind of backed the wrong horse. He's got a history of that. But yeah, any other thoughts or should we move on?
No, let's keep going.
I don't know. I will say, to answer your question, Chase, I don't know that it's conclusively proven that Melisandre's actions are what brought back Jon back to life, because there was that gap of her washing his hair and doing her voodoo, and then he came to life on his own. So you could certainly argue that point, and without the books to kind of give his background and more information, like. But it certainly seems like everyone in the show gives the Lord of Light credit for bringing him back to life, even Jon himself.
Yeah,
he'll say, I don't understand it, but he doesn't deny it. Zachary T, you've brought up several times this season why Arya wouldn't use her Faceless Man wild card triple death wish to kill anyone of importance like Joffrey or Cersei. I have a theory as to why that you haven't yet addressed. She wants to kill them herself. Arya in season 2 is at somewhat of a transition point where she's balancing survival with a need for revenge. Perhaps her choosing not to name these big fish to Jaqen, who have personally caused her so much anguish, is the beginning of her brutal mission to complete her kill list herself. When she kills Meryn Trant in the end of season 5, she tells him, I'm glad the many-faced god saved you for me. In season 7, she and Sansa both lament not being the ones to have the privilege to kill Joffrey. What do you think?
Yeah, that seems totally reasonable.
I do think that there is a point where, like, Tywin is riding forth from the gates, where if she had the wish and Jaqen right in front of her, she would have wished for his death right there. Because she hasn't quite made that transition. But this is a compelling point of why she wouldn't just, like, name her top three off her list. Because she wants to be the one.
Yeah, and I think it's something that she could be doing even subconsciously. You know, not naming him, not because she hasn't thought of him.
Right,
or,
like, I'm going to save her for later, just like, you know.
Or, yeah, not that she specifically wants to save him for later, but that's kind of just on her radar in general.
Right.
And she's making that decision without consciously making it.
Good takes. Jake from Cincinnati. When Tyrion wakes after the battle, he discovers he's lost a handship, his looks, and his Vale Mountain Clan warriors have been paid and sent home by his father, who's now acting hand. These Vale Mountain clansmen can be seen flanking Tyrion throughout the season, including in the attack Tyrion led at the Blackwater. I'm not sure if there are more to these guys in the book or if their role fans out like it does in the show, but it got me thinking. Tyrion, now handed the Queen, is heading north. The Vale of Arryn is just south of White Harbor, and his company is in an ever-desperate need of allies. Do you see Tyrion calling upon these mountain warriors to his aid?
Yeah, he could.
My question is, why the fuck would they heed his call? Like, this was a
transaction.
Opportunity
for more gold.
I guess. Like, that would be interesting if we find the mountain clans and they've kind of, like, they're like Novu-ish.
Right. They bought a bunch of expensive art.
Like, they've upgraded.
They hung it on their walls.
Yeah, exactly. But it's
shag,
like,
carpeting.
It's kind of like, you know, like, I don't want, I'll stick to my personal, like, you know, it's an interesting phenomenon because when I grew up, we have a lot of tornadoes and storms. That's a lot of trailer parks.
Very true.
And when you'd see a storm cut through a trailer park, their phenomenon of the trailer parks getting the trailers being gussied up. Mm-hmm. Let's say someone actually builds an actual, I've seen this with my own, actual roof over their trailer with a nice wood deck, and they've got, like, you know, like, who knows what riches, untold riches they have inside the trailer itself.
Uh-huh.
But, like, that version of the hill tribes, like, they're still living in mud huts, but now they've got, like, gold jewelry and silver plates and shit like that.
All right.
They haven't quite acquired the class and taste as befits their wealth and status.
Uh-huh.
But now, and they're like, well, shit. We still live in a mud hut, man. We need to, like, and Tyrion comes and says, I'll give you castles or something.
Yeah, I wouldn't buy that they'd be, prepared enough for that kind of wealth to use it properly. They just put swimming pools in the back.
Well, here's,
like, above ground swimming pools, too. Not even the good
kind.
You
know what he could promise them?
Ferrari in the driveway of the trailer park.
He, like, could actually promise them the fucking Vale.
Yeah.
Because who's around to, like, are
Robin?
Sweet Robin? Are we going to shed some crocodile tears if he gets fucked out of his of his house? No. And that's what they've always wanted, right?
As a matter of fact, I would love to see him fly.
The Knights of the Vale, they hate him because the Knights of the Vale run him into the hills where they're kept poor and starving the whole time. They don't have good weapons, and they don't have good steel. So, like, he could offer him the Vale. I guess that would be interesting. And they'd probably take him up on that offer.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We'll see if they do. I think we've got a plausible path toward this happening. We'll see if they take it, Jake.
At the same time, all of the Hills tribesmen that they had on staff couldn't defeat Tywin when he came back.
True.
And we do know that they still have a large army at King's Landing, or in the Lannister employ.
Right.
So I don't know.
Wait, they weren't working to defeat Tywin.
Or, sorry, not Tywin. Stannis.
Okay.
Yeah. Couldn't repel Stannis' troops when he landed. So how much are they actually worth?
That's a good question. However much gold Tywin paid him, I guess. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, what are they going to be especially good fighters against the White Walker? You do need manpower, though.
Maybe. Yeah.
We'll see. Tavis from Morgantown, West Virginia. In season 7, Daenerys had a resounding rival at Dragonstone, and rightfully so. This is where ancestors fled hundreds of years ago before the Doom of Valyria. It's where they launched their conquering of Westeros. It's where Dany was born and escaped from after Robert's Rebellion. It's fitting for her to have an emotional sequence returning quote-unquote home. But why didn't she get the same treatment at King's Landing? At the Dragon Pit, many of the main characters assemble to make a truce and discuss a real war with the White Walkers and the Army of the Dead. Daenerys comes in late, but in grand fashion on the back of Drogon. However, I wanted to see some recognition of her glimpsing King's Landing for the first time and it moving her. I know the showrunners wanted to play up the mystery of where Daenerys was and to shock Cersei a bit, but I think they missed an opportunity.
Hmm.
Well, I mean, the thing is, you know, King's Landing is a hostile city. Like, she can't just walk around and, like, gawk and gape and, like, oh my, and, like, touch the ground and shed tears. Like, she's trying to be this strong thing. Like, I think if they gave her that scene, a lot of people on the internet would say, oh, God, Daenerys looks weak.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think he's talking about, like, from, like, an aerial, like, from the dragon.
Hmm. Yeah, I guess they could have done that where she kind of, like, looks longingly at King's Landing as a whole.
But maybe I'm just completely blanking on this, but is there a reason for her to have a special, like, affinity for
King's
Landing?
Kind of like this is the city that Aegon built. This was his grand vision. Okay. There was no King's Landing. There was no king in Westeros. Like,
gotcha.
Of all, and this is that he made through his own sheer force of will, I guess, is what the thing. But I felt like there was some with her and Jon reflecting on how her people became. This is where they shut away her dragons became. Like, they did have the reflection. It wasn't like a grandiose one. It was more. Like, Dragonstone is where she had the grandiose, like, oh my god, I'm
coming
home and
yeah.
look at what I've done and I'm awesome. The dragon pit was more of a cautionary, like, when yeah. we forget who we are and where we come from, this is what happens to us.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, like I said, I think it would have been weird to put that moment in. That's just my opinion. Nick Kay, Lord Varys has insisted on more than one occasion that he serves the realm, but I'm not so sure. He claims to act in interests of stability and peace, but he's more often taking steps to destabilize the realm, not to avoid war. Right from the start in Season 1, Arya overhears him and Illyrio plotting to foment the Targaryen restoration, but as hard as Varys worked to restore Daenerys, he's been oddly absent in guiding her ascension, instead leaving Tyrion to exercise influence over her, whose life story has been one of poor judgment where pretty women who treat him well is concerned. I think he wants chaos and not peace. His origin story revolves around his root and stem, or lack thereof, but what if Varys was a willing participant, instead of a victim, in sacrificing his manhood to whatever god is empowering the Night King? The flame turned blue and the sacrifice was made, same as the Dragon White's breath. What if Varys is Melisandre's equivalent for the Lord of Darkness? There's a lot of magic in these lady in those parts, as we saw early on. Might Illyrio be a sorcerer? Why did that dude have 3 dragon eggs?
A lot of fucking questions in there.
Yeah, we got
kind of
it started off
together.
Solid, and we got off into the weeds a bit. Like I said, I just laid out a compelling plot line for why Varys could be a bad guy without actually being a capital B, capital G bad guy,
right? And without having the you know, the old switcheroo pulled on the audience, too.
Right, that I'm actually a dark warlord.
Right. Yeah, I... Maybe I shouldn't. Maybe I'm a fool for believing this, but I think when Varys has those very somber moments where he talks about, you know, what happened to him, and he catches the man who did this to him and imprisons him in a box, you know, like, I think those moments are genuine. And maybe I'm a fool for it.
I agree.
Maybe
with
Varys
you. So if
just,
you're a fool, we're in it together.
Yeah, those feel like genuine moments from a person who is traumatized by this thing, not someone who is masquerading under this guise of revenge, when in fact he was the person who used his parts to become a dark wizard. I don't know.
I mean, if you want to go super tinfoily, I did a dive on this in Season 5, I think. But there's an interesting fan theory about the nature of Varys and Illyrio's relationship.
Mm-hmm.
That and there's like, you know, strong and weak versions of this theory. But like one of them, if you read the books and Dance of Dragons goes into this, that, you know, Varys and Illyrio had this whole thing where Varys would use his cunning and his stealth to sneak in and steal things of value from people, and then Illyrio would come in as a sellsword and say, "I know the brigand that did this, and I can get you. I can recover your thing for a fee."
Yeah.
And they would do this like fence and recovery operation, and essentially double dip on their money.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a theory, the weak version of which is this, that Varys and Illyrio are essentially running the same kind of rip and run strategy writ large.
Mm-hmm.
And if they can put their main, like in the books, if they can put their guy Aegon Targaryen on the throne, then they essentially win the entire Seven Kingdoms. Or in the show, if it's they put Dany on the throne, then essentially they get to own the whole Seven Kingdoms. And this whole thing with Robert's Rebellion was essentially that, stealing something and then selling it back to someone at a high price all over again.
I feel like if that is their plan.
The strong tinfoil version of that is Varys is not a man, but he's a woman. He's Illyrio's fucking black
wife.
Blackfyre Targaryen wife.
Uh-huh.
And Aegon's their illegitimate Targaryen son.
Oh, boy.
And they're doing it upright. Like, I mean, again.
Yeah. So none of that has to be true. But if you're going to say that this is the rip and run strategy for Westeros, then I think they have seriously underestimated or misestimated you know, miscalculated on who Danny is.
Sure.
Because Danny's not that person who they're going to be controlling.
Danny's not a rube that they're going to sell back her possessions to.
Absolutely not. She's someone who's going to destroy the system they're trying to take advantage of, if that's the case, you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, miscalculation, if that's their plan.
Well, yeah. I mean, the fact that, again, Melisandre, not to put too fine a point on it, says you're a dead man.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I didn't, and the way she said it, it's not like old age in bed.
Right.
So, moving on, Adam K. Got a quick question for you. Isn't Gendry an heir to the throne? No, he's not. Like, I mean, that's the thing, like, as I say many, many times.
Unless he can amass an army.
If he can amass an army.
And take it by force.
And take it by force. Then the fact that he's actually the bastard son of Robert would probably go a long way to convincing the lords and ladies, all right, we'll go along with this. Because he's got a claim, and he's also got this massive army, and what are we going to do?
Yeah.
But no, he has not even the whiff of a legitimate claim. Because, like, if Robert had no legitimate issue... Because bastards have no claim to shit in Westerosi politics. Mm-hmm. Then the rightful heir was Stannis, and then Renly, and probably some other. You'd have to go off into some obscure Baratheon branch of the family. But there's no fucking way that Renly can be a legitimate heir.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean he can't take the Red Keep, and it doesn't mean he can't sit on the throne. It doesn't mean that he couldn't rule as king. It just means he doesn't have any legitimate claim.
Yeah, I mean, he would have
but
to
neither
go
did
on
Robert
the Jon
Baratheon.
Snow journey, right?
Right, exactly.
From no claim to being essentially elected by the people of the North as King of the North.
The only way he could have a legitimate claim is if a current king of Westeros declared him legitimate and then presumably abdicated the throne or died, then he could potentially be a legitimate heir.
Yeah.
But as a bastard, he's like the end of Willy Wonka. You get nothing. Good day, sir. Be gone. You know, all that. I can't quote it from memory. Jonathan H. Oh, wait. He has another, I forgot, and cutting off his point, that he had another question. If the Night King can see the future, why do you throw the second spear and miss?
All part of the plan. All part of the plan, baby.
The Visions promised him a dragon. He got greedy.
It's so they'll think he can miss, and the next time he won't.
Right. Turns out he's just, he was sandbagging, because he's like... Will Ferrell, an elf with snowballs with those ice spears. He can just chuck them 16 spears a second with unerring accuracy. Dragon's super fucked. This is all part of his master plan. But no, seriously, like, you know, if Melisandre can get shit wrong, I'm assuming the Night King can too. I don't think the Night King is literally a god. I think the Night King might be getting receptions from a potential evil god, but I don't think he is God. So then he can misunderstand shit as well as the next ice zombie.
Yeah.
Jonathan H., am I right in assuming that Season 6 and 7 contain roughly the same content that Winds of Winter will eventually contain? Does this mean that Season 8 will roughly have the same content as A Dream of Spring? And if true, how much of Season 8 will be satisfying content where all loose ends are tied up?
I feel bad for you, because I think you're wasting your effort.
I think he's right, though, that the wall falling feels like a climax to Winds of War.
Winds of Winter?
Winds of Winter, rather.
Sure. Yeah, totally.
Because, like, that's, like, in A Dream of Spring, like, things start turning good.
Right. The wall coming down is the worst thing you can imagine when it comes to the White Walkers.
So, like, I can't believe that A Dream of Spring would contain that. So, yeah, I think you're right, but it's an open question whether these books even get written. And
yeah,
then
that's
who
what
the
I
fuck
mean.
Knows. And also, like, George Martin, there was a lot of the preview chapters of Winds of Winter were shit that he cut from Dance with Dragons. So, like, what is in the book and isn't in the book is kind of an arbitrary thing. There's some suggestion right now from the more hopeful fans that he actually has the books finished. It's just a debate of which chapter goes where. Or where exactly. It's like, you know, again, like, I get, like, at least a weekly basis someone saying, don't you think it's possible that he's got both the books done and he's just waiting for it? And I'm like,
how long do you have that debate before you go, you know what? It doesn't really matter.
Right.
Let's just put the chapters, let's make them roughly the same length, and let's put them out.
Yeah. And like,
because our fans are pissed.
And also, what does his publisher think?
Yeah.
Like, if it got out that he is just sitting there and, like, not able to call one half of his book Winds and the other Dream, I think that they would get some, how do you strong arm Martin at this point?
Right.
He doesn't need your fucking advance.
With a prearranged contract, I guess, unless he doesn't have one.
But I'm saying, like, their sole remedy is probably taking their advance back, and he'd be like, who gives a shit?
Or taking him to court, one or two.
Yeah, but that'd be ugly.
Very.
That'd be ugly taking a creator to trial for having writer's block, essentially.
I mean, if he's got a contract and he says, you know, it'll be done at X date, something he's got to honor.
I think
legally.
He should just do it because, like, there is an implicit, like, you know, there is an implicit promise when you start a series that you're going to fucking finish it.
Or at least try.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like,
I mean,
you know,
in a Robert Jordan situation, look, I get it.
Kickstarter can say all they want about how this is, you know, gambling money, essentially, and nobody's responsible for everything, but it's always a shit show when people don't deliver or make an earnest attempt to deliver. So I feel like there's at least that minimal, like, we've invested in 5 books, we would like to see 6 and 7, without, like, you know, death or a serious debilitating illness being an excuse for it. That's what my relationship with Martin is anyway. Last email of the show and of the season, Costa M. My question is: now that we know John's real name is Aegon, I probably will never want to refer to him as such. In that respect, on Stranger Things, we also find out this is a spoiler for Stranger Things, but it's just like, okay, less spoilery. Everyone is introduced to the character of Crazy Eyes on Orange is the New Black as Crazy Eyes. She later confides or tells you, we find her name is Susan. And at what point are you kind of being a dick by using essentially a slur that she's called in the prison yard as her name instead of referring to her as her actual name, Susan? And I think where it comes down to is when a person says, I have a clear preference for being called something, you're kind of a dick if you don't respect that. Like, you're Jim. Yeah. If someone insisted on calling you Jimmy and you said, no, I'm actually Jim, and they continued, or you said, I'm actually James, and they continued to ignore that, you'd think, well, he's just being an asshole. He's trying to piss me off, right?
Uh-huh.
What other purpose could he have by intentionally mislabeling me?
Right.
So if John finds out that he's Aegon Targaryen and has a strong preference for people coming around and calling him Aegon, then I guess I'll have to start fucking calling him Aegon because that's the respectful thing to do.
Right.
Why? Am I in denial, or do I think that even if John finds out, he's going to still want to be called John?
I mean, it's all he's ever
known. The only father he's ever known gave him.
Yeah, and I think that name means a lot to him at this point. You know, he's done so much with it. Whether he's a Snow or not, that John name.
That's the thing, like, him taking the Targaryen last name and being John Targaryen first of his name, totally cool with. Totally cool with.
Okay.
The Aegon,
I think it's the Aegon part,
is where I start getting, like, kind of like, that's dumb.
Yeah.
But I don't know, because the thing is I think it's going to be a narrative statement no matter what happens. If he rejects Aegon and keeps Targaryen, that says something about the choice he's making in his life. If he embraces Aegon Targaryen full tilt, that also says something about what is going on with this character.
Yeah, they're kind of setting him up to have this interesting sort of Theon trial, right?
Right.
Where he has to decide who he's going to be.
Right.
Based on the 2 different names he has.
Right.
We'll see which one he goes with.
I think that Jon Targaryen, that would also be a nice, another ice and fire, because he keeps the name that his Stark father gave him, but he takes the last name of the Targaryen house that he belongs to.
Yeah.
So, like, I guess if John comes and says, I want everyone to call me Aegon now, like, it's pretentious, but I'm going to have to do it.
Maybe he'll come in and be like, you know what? I found out I got 2 different names. Fuck all this. I've always wanted to be called Donald. Call me Donald from now on.
Right.
Would you call him Donald?
I mean, if someone,
would that be a hard pill to swallow, though, in our coverage?
I mean, it would be, but you get used to it. Like I said, there's always, I saw this Orange is the New Black. There's always a point where she's Crazy Eyes, and then, like, interchangeably Crazy Eyes Susan, and then later seasons, if you slip up and call her Crazy Eyes, or even refer to her as Crazy Eyes in a scene when she's called Crazy Eyes, fans will get all fucking pissed because you're now disrespecting the character.
Sure.
And I think that's what you just, So, yeah, it'll be a rough transition, so say we all, but John wants to be called fucking Aegon, then I guess, you know, it'd be like, well, it's like, going back to my insensitive roots comparison. If Kunta Kinte is all about being called Toby, not a big deal.
Right.
Not a big deal. If he wants to be called Toby, then fucking call him Toby. If he wants to be called, Kunta Kinte, then you should refer to him Kunta Kinte, because that's his name.
The good news is you won't have much time to either fuck this up or be uncomfortable with it or anything, because show's almost over.
It's true.
So at most, like, if he comes back first scene, season 8, and says, call me Aegon,
right?
You got one season to deal with it. It's not that big a deal. You're going to have that transition period. It's going to be quick.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. Like, there's not going to be enough time for fans to get, like, really strong feelings about the Aegon. Like, if this was the hypothetical Aeron's 10th season, I guarantee if he says, I want to be called Aegon, and we continue to call him John, we'd start getting shit for it.
For sure.
Rightfully so, because then you're making a statement about yourself as a podcaster, that you're either going to willfully dismiss the show's claim of his actual name, which says something about your relationship with the show, or you don't give a shit. You don't care enough to keep it straight, which also says something about your relationship with the show, which is what these names and how we use them, it all comes back to how we feel about the person we're talking about.
Sure.
You know, so, and there's all, if you use your imagination, there's all points in real life where you can take this lesson to heart and not be assholes to each other. Maybe. And that's it. That's it. That's it for the season. That's it for season two. Close it on the books. We only got one more season. Well, one more season in season 8, and we have yet another show with full coverage, Jim.
That's right. Yeah, we got to get through season 3, season 8, and it's all downhill from there.
Again, unfortunately, cannot be specific about the schedule. We will be looking for a 10-week gap in our full tilt, full coverage schedule. Like, honestly, if we did a better job looking ahead, probably not have done season 2 right after season 7 because it really put us behind the 8-ball at a lot of things.
But you know, doing it before would have also been a mistake. Like, it was crammed full. We had 3 shows before, we have 3 shows after. It's not been easy.
Sometimes there's not a great time. But now, with surely a year between now and Game of Thrones coming back at the minimum, surely we can find a slot to put that stuff in.
Surely.
Again, follow us on social media on Bald Move if you'd like to be up to date with the latest decision. We probably also something we can talk about on the, you know, will be mentioned on the forums. It's also, if you just keep checking baldmove.com or subscribe to our Game of Thrones feed. The second you get a podcast drop, it pops up in your notifications, and that's the best way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's also best for us. So if that makes anything, then do that.
Mutually beneficial.
And there you go. I'm just stalling because I've been talking about Game of Thrones for 20 weeks. It's going to feel weird not to, but...
I find we always do this at the end of a season.
Right.
Because we know we want more. We know the fans want more.
It's because it's in my DNA. Everything makes me want to say, we'll see you next week. Until then.
Yeah.
But I can't say next week. I can't say next year. I can't even say next season.
I'll see you next year. I think we could say that.
We're going to get this done in 2018. We're going to make that vow.
Yeah.
All right. We will see you in 2018. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Later.